The crisp but sunbright season of winter in Napoli was now upon them. Life goes on, Sigismundo thought, even for us damned ones. It is as I felt it that day in Arezzo. Millions come, millions pass, millions die. The fabric is always changing, but always the same. Life goes on. Then they heard that a Rosso had been burned in Palermo. He died cursing, the reports said. He called up 777 demons, even as the flames engulfed him, and implored them to fall upon the Pope, the King, the Cardinals, the landlords, and especially the oral copulating secret police, inflicting all with blindness, pox, and idiocy. Whomever this demoniac was, he was not one of the four who had killed Uncle Leonardo. Uncle Pietro had obtained a full description. This man had never been in Napoli at all. Nobody recognized him. Finally, as Advent began, and everybody was preparing for Christmas and the visit of the three wise men, the Dominicans announced that they were finally bringing the Umbertos to trial, the banker's family who had been arrested for witchcraft on July 23rd. Very speedy work for the Inquisition, Uncle Pietro commented in a low voice to Sigismundo. Usually, they hold people 2 or 3 years before having all the confessions they want. Since school was out for the holidays, Pietro suggested that Sigismundo come with him and observe a day of the Umberto trial. I am sure it will be full of fun and rollicking good humor, Sigismundo said grimly, like the mating rituals of spiders. Uncle Pietro did not smile. It will show you a face of the Catholic faith that Father Ratti does not present to you, he said. He, in fact, would like to see it abolished. I think you should come. Education consists of knowing what the world is really like. The day they attended was the highlight of the show for everybody. Signor Umberto was making his confession. Why did you join the Strege? The Grand Inquisitor was asking as they entered. He was a kindly-looking old man with a sorrowful face. He really believes in what he is doing, Sigismundo thought, and regrets that inflicting pain is part of it. Some of the Dominicanis were just thugs in theological uniform, but this man had the self-lacerating sincerity of Saint Kevin, who had let his sweetheart die outside the monastery gate because he had sworn never to look upon a woman again. Old Umberto, on the other hand, looked exactly like the end result of that kind of sincerity. He was a hideous caricature of the proud rich man he had been only a half a year ago. His face, his hands, even his legs were monstrously swollen. His eyes might have been looking into the deepest mineshaft in Finland, seeing nothing but darkness and endless abyss. It was my aunt, Umberto said. She taught me. She was a Stregia? Yes, she said it had been in the family since the Roman Empire. How old were you when your aunt led you into the paths of Satan? 14. Sigismundo remembered Abraham saying he should keep a record of coincidences. Why did she wish you to join in her evil works? She said that it must always be passed on to a child so that it never dies out. Sigismundo jumped at the words. But the quality of Umberto's voice was beginning to register on him. It was an actor's voice, but not very professional. The confession had been rehearsed many times, but the banker still did not speak with total conviction. Did she take you to a sabbat? Yes, in Eboli, before we moved north. There were 13 at the sabbat. Was there a leader? She was the priestess herself. The male leader, her consort, was called only the Black Man. Il Negro, Umberto had said in ordinary Italian. El Aswad, the Rossi said in Arabic, but the meaning was the same. Was the devil worshipped? Yes, they called him Lucifer. Were other devils invoked? Yes, a she-devil named Aradia, and a Greek musical devil named Orpheus, and the devil's mother, Dana. She was the devil to invoke for success in hunting. The connection leaped into Sigismundo's mind. Diana, Dana, Tana. The Strege and Rossi both had kept parts of a tradition that went back to the most ancient moon goddess of southern Italy. Was it possible that the fat and faceless Tana was the oldest form of the idea, going back to Vico's age of cave dwellers? What did you do at the Sabbat? The Inquisitor asked. We danced and sang. And then? One of the women was possessed by Dana. She answered questions. What sort of questions? Where lost objects were? Who would get married soon? She always answered in poetry. How long did this demonic possession continue? All night. She answered many questions. Sometimes she made jokes. Blasphemous jokes? No, just jokes about people in the circle. There was a long pause. The inquisitors conferred in low voices. Let the prisoner be taken out, the Grand Inquisitor said sadly, with real pain in his voice. Show him the instruments again. No, Umberto said hurriedly. I didn't remember. Please, your honors, it is clear to me again. Were there blasphemous jokes? Yes, she ridiculed Jesus and the Blessed Virgin. Were there further blasphemies? Umberto looked around vaguely, like a man who was not sure what city he was in or how he had gotten there. We blasphemed the holy sacraments of the church, he said, almost mumbling. We said the Lord's Prayer backward. We urinated on a host. And then? The Inquisitor prompted. Umberto looked at the floor. We murdered an infant and ate its flesh. There was an outburst in the audience, and soldiers had to be called to restore order. Well? Uncle Pietro asked when the Holy Office recessed for the afternoon siesta. He and Sigismundo were walking in the Palazzo Reale, which was mostly deserted at that hour. I don't know what to think, Sigismundo said. His swollen hands. That was the thumbscrew? Of course. Then the other swellings. Similar instruments. Sigismundo moved closer to the center of the empty palazzo, further from all neighboring houses. Are there real Strege? He asked. How can you doubt it, when so many infallible popes have declared, no more irony, please, just tell me. I think there are Strege, Uncle Pietro whispered. There are many with the power, in every country. Village healers, people with second sight, old women who know herbal remedies and then learn other secrets because, well, people always tend to form clubs. There are as many occult clubs, probably, as there are styles of painting or forms of music. There is a legend that once there was only one club, and all those with a fourth soul were members. But then came the Inquisition and the burnings. The club was destroyed. Maybe it happened that way, or maybe whenever two or three people with the power get together, they start inventing a club to organize what they're doing. Do the Strege really eat babies, or do the Dominicans just make them say these things with the thumbscrew and other instruments? What do you think? I told you, I don't know what to think. Well, neither do I, Uncle Pietro said. Some clubs are very nasty indeed, as you have reason to know. The Dominicans also have inflamed imaginations and tools that would make the Pope himself confess that he is the pigeon who made Mary heavy with Christ. Pietro sighed. That is what is devilish about the Dominicanis. One never knows what to believe about a confession obtained with their methods. Let us stroll down to the Osteria Pompei and have some scampi. I'm famished. That afternoon, old man Umberto confessed to increasingly bizarre deeds, sodomy and incest and cursing people's cows so that they could not give milk, and flying through the air to a giant sabbat in Bavaria where witches from all over Europe met on May Eve. The Dominicans expected to hear all that from a Strege, Sigismundo reflected. As long as Umberto denied such things, he was by definition obdurate in his heresy. And the torture would continue. The Strege might be as innocent as a country dancing society, or they might be as vicious as the Rossi. It was impossible to judge from outside. But it was not impossible to judge the inquisitors themselves. The Grand Inquisitor might be very sad and very sincere, but he presided over an academy of torture. Sigismundo remembered Father Ratti explaining the spiritual exercises of San Ignatius Loyola. These exercises use the imagination to train the will. The technique was to make an imagined scene so real that the mind reacted as if it were real. For instance, every Jesuit had to go through the crucifixion of Christ in his training. Father Ratti himself had done it. The candidate had to imagine every detail vividly and more vividly until it was as if he had been put to sleep by Dr. Orfali and lived it. He had to imagine and live the pain of being whipped and the agony of the crown of thorns and the cruel nails being driven through his palms and the wrenching of every muscle when the cross was lifted and hanging there in the hot sun all afternoon. To be a Jesuit, you had to feel all that and feel the blood run out of your side as you were pierced by the centurion's sword, and you had to die willingly for all humanity as he did. And as you died in this vivid fantasy, you had to sincerely forgive those who crucified you, as he did. In that way, in that heightened imagination, you became one with Christ. That was what it was meant to be a Jesuit. The Dominicans, Sigismundo thought, have their own spiritual exercise, without realizing what they are doing. By contemplating Satan and hell so vividly in their imaginations, over and over and over again, they have gradually become one with Satan and hell. That is what it means to be an inquisitor. Umberto was being asked to name the black man who led the coven of witches in Napoli. He was merely Il Negro, Banker said. Names were not exchanged. Describe him then, the Grand Inquisitor said. He was young, very young, a Siciliano, I'm sure, very dark. A thin face. About as tall as I am, and he had a touch of violet in his eyes, as if there were some blue-eyed Normans among his ancestors. Sigismundo started. He knew that Siciliano face with violet-flecked eyes. It had spared him once in San Francesco di Paola. Brother, it had said another time, you were born to be one of us. So, there was a connection between the witches and the Rossi. And as usual, in this peninsula of tangled plots and endless conspiracies, this kingdom of philosophical spaghetti, the inevitable question was, who is using whom? Are the witches infiltrating the Rossi, or vice versa? He suddenly wondered if the pseudo-Frankenstein, whomever or whatever he was, had just happened to come to Napoli by accident. And did he have words of ambiguous advice for S.B.? Just by picking two initials out of the air? And what experiments by the real Frankenstein had led to all those terrible legends in Bavaria? Sigismundo was beginning to see connections, links, patterns, everywhere. And I am trapped in the center of the web, he thought. Even the stars have conspired to put me there, according to the Rossi. What did I ever do to the stars that they should have such malignant intentions toward me? And why did Uncle Pietro want me to hear this? Federico Umberto was burned on San Stefano's Day, right after Christmas. Sigismundo did not attend the auto da fe. He had never seen a public burning and had no desire to add such a spectacle to his education. He was revolted enough by the celebrations that broke out in every neighborhood in Napoli. It began at 9 a.m, when Umberto was being torched. All the churches in Napoli started tolling their bells at once to thank God for this deliverance from evil. Then people spontaneously came out of their houses and started bonfires. Soon, wine bottles were being opened, and street dances were beginning. At noon, the cannons were fired for the first time, and thereafter, every hour until midnight, there was another blast. It seemed to get louder as the day wore on. Somebody had found some extra cannons, Sigismundo supposed. All the dogs in the city were hiding under beds and howling in protest. A sane man, Sigismundo thought, might consider the propriety of joining them. In the afternoon, the crowds prevailed on the priests at San Domenico Maggiore, and the Madonna was brought out, in her robes of woven gold, and paraded through the streets for the rest of the day. By then, musicians with horns and drums and trumpets and fiddles were going from one neighborhood to another. It was turning into a classic Neapolitan holiday. All we need, Sigismundo thought, is the indispensable drunk to fall through a stained glass window into one of the churches. Half the population was falling down drunk by sunset. Another half was in the churches singing the litanies. As twilight came on, the cannons were joined by fireworks of every description. The sky was soon as brilliantly chaotic as Sigismundo's hallucinations on Belladonna. At times you couldn't tell the moon and stars from the other lights. And the cannons seemed to fire continuously now, and the church bells seemed never to stop clanging either. The dances grew wilder and more licentious. The Dominicans would not like this part of it. There will be 100 brand new ex-virgins tomorrow, Uncle Pietro said, and 100 sudden marriages next month. By now it was as if Mardi Gras had come early, as if the wine had been spiked with strange drugs. People began shooting pistols and muskets into the air to add to the booming of the cannons and the banging of the fireworks, as if all the pent-up passions from the time of Adam himself were running amok in delirium of celebration that seemed always on the razor's edge of madness. There was no street not alight with torches, not resounding to trumpets and hunting horns and shrill, demented-sounding violins. If the fourth soul is innate in all things, as Abraham says, Sigismundo thought, this must be what nature feels like in the spring, when she begins to sprout forth new buds and bushes and trees of all sorts. But why does it take a man's death to unleash this energy? Are we still Dionysians, only pretending to be Christians? He remembered from the Bible. But who may abide the day of his coming, and who shall stand when he appeareth? Does that really refer to the Messiah, he wondered, or to the dark side of the fourth soul that the Rossi wish to unleash? Are the Dominicans serving the same demonic force without even knowing it? Finally, a group of drunks went down to the ghetto and began burning and looting at random. The police were called, and then, the frenzy having risen higher, the battle spread backward from the ghetto to the main parts of Napoli. People who had been singing and beating drums and dancing now decided to express their opinion of Bourbon rule by hiding on roofs and hurling bricks and rocks at the police. Some even emptied their chamber pots, which was called giving the cops a Sicilian bouquet, although Uncle Pietro said people in the north called it Neapolitan confetti. By dawn, a semblance of order had returned, but then the most disgraceful details became public knowledge. Two policemen had been killed, their skulls cracked by flying bricks. One drunk had blinded himself by igniting a Roman candle the wrong way round, and another, as Sigismundo had expected, actually did fall through a stained glass window, at the cathedral no less. The woven gold robe of the Holy Virgin was stolen by miscreants during the riot, and a little 11-year-old girl had been brutally gang-raped and beaten by hooligans from God knows where. Most edifying, Uncle Pietro said. How holy we have all become now that the witch is burned and the evil driven out of our city. But Sigismundo suddenly realized that behind his uncle's habitual irony there was, always, a terrible sadness and weariness. On January 17th, the notorious Casanova arrived for a secret meeting with the Malatesta family. The formidable rascal had come by night, and very secretly, it appeared. He was at Uncle Pietro's, and something of importance was afoot. Papa Guido had a strange look in his eye when he told Sigismundo that all the men of the family were meeting Casanova up there on Capodimonte. At least Sigismundo was now regarded as one of the men, perhaps because he had passed his 15th birthday, perhaps because they had all grown tired of trying to exclude him from the men's business. There were many legends about Giovanni Jacopo Casanova de Seingalt. Most incredible of all was that even cynics agreed that more than half of the legends were true. This was the man who had been imprisoned for sorcery in Venice and had escaped so marvelously that some insisted he must have walked through the walls. Others, however, said that Casanova was a ringleader in the International Masonic Conspiracy, and his brother Freemasons had gotten him out by outrageously huge bribes at all levels, from the Duke and the Bishop down to the common jailers and the hangman's assistants' cousins. Some said that he was not Casanova de Seingalt at all, but just plain Casanova, the child of a common actor, and that he had invented a noble title for himself to gain entry to high places. That he had served as a spy for more than one prince was established beyond doubt. How many state secrets he knew, and how many he had sold to the highest bidder, was a subject of endless speculation. Yet despite this uncouth background, spying was bad enough, but to have an actor for a father was positively sordid. Casanova de Seingalt, or plain Casanova, whichever he was, had become rich and mighty in France, selling alchemical secrets to the nobles. He had chemicals that doctors did not know about, it was said, and could show you heaven while you were still alive. He could also heal wounds of all sorts. In fact, he had once shot a nobleman in a duel, healed him with one of these elixirs, became his friend, and, exploiting that connection for all it was worth, obtained a royal charter to run the state lottery. It was also known that Casanova had a diploma in law and had performed as a violinist in leading opera houses, and it was furthermore alleged that he was a notorious card sharp who had made his original fortune cheating at casinos. And there was the legend, too, that when Casanova was in town, wise men locked their wives in the attics, hid their daughters in the cellars, and hired guards for their elderly aunts. When Papa Guido and Sigismundo arrived at Uncle Pietro's house, Casanova was in the middle of a long story. Naturally, he was the hero of the anecdote, which involved an argument with Voltaire. To hear Casanova tell it, he had made a ring-tailed monkey of the French philosopher. "I'm sure Voltaire tells the story otherwise," Sigismundo thought, looking over the man who had such an astonishing reputation as magician, spy, musician, seducer, alchemist, novelist, card sharp, and master of conspiracies. Casanova was about 40, but quite athletic-looking still. "He'd better be," Sigismundo thought, with his unsavory reputation trailing behind him like hired mutes moaning behind a hearse. He had an actor's handsomeness, or perhaps it was an actor's skill at comporting himself to show his best features, and nobody in the world was dressed in such gaudy and stupendous attire. In all Napoli, the only object more astonishing was the Teatro San Carlo itself. It must take a day and a half to get him dressed, Sigismundo thought, but that is how he inspires confidence, of course. Princes look a bit drab next to him. "So I said to him," Casanova was finishing his story, "pigs will become sculptors and horses will paint murals before man truly becomes a rational animal." "He teaches lessons to philosophers," Sigismundo thought, "when he isn't walking through prison walls, performing alchemical miracles, or contending for the International Bastardy Award." By now, most of the Malatesta and Cellina men were in the room. Uncle Carlo, Uncle Francesco, cousins Antonio and Paolo, Uncle Benito, Uncle Alfredo, Uncle Eduardo, Papa Guido, and Sigismundo himself. And Aunt Gina was present, too, the only woman there. Sigismundo began to realize what was coming. Mama had spoken of the money Uncle Pietro had distributed to his contacts. Casanova had even more contacts. Networks of conspiracy crisscrossed Napoli, the Papal States, Genoa, Tuscany, and France. Anything was possible with enough money, enough time. "Justice," as Pietro said once, "is so high and holy a thing that it belongs exclusively to those wise enough and rich enough to know where to buy it." "Where is the swine?" Aunt Gina asked suddenly. Sigismundo looked at her. She was not as haggard as in the first months after the murder. She was almost pretty again, if somewhat older looking than her real age. She would be pretty, he thought, if it wasn't for that look in her eyes, that look that reminded him of gargoyles on old cathedrals. Casanova dragged a large box in from the back hall. A box big enough to hold a man, Sigismundo thought. "There is, the balance of my fee," Casanova said. Without a word, Uncle Pietro handed him a bag. Sigismundo was startled by the size of it. Even if it was only full of lire, it would be a great deal of money. Pietro accompanied Casanova to the door, where they shook hands with a grip that Sigismundo now recognized as Masonic. "We met on the square," Pietro said. "And we part on the level," Casanova replied. "Ride like the wind," Pietro said. "We just had a burning last month. The Dominicans are gaining power again." When Casanova left, Aunt Gina asked impatiently, "The leader?"
"I wouldn't pay so much for anyone else," Pietro said.
Something happened in the room. Nobody made a sound, but everything changed. It was like the hour when the air becomes stifling before the thunder crashes, Sigismundo thought. "The leader, my father." Pietro and Papa Guido and Uncle Carlo took the box apart with hammers and chisels. Peppino Bosalmo, bound and gagged, sat amid the splinters, looking at all of them. Sigismundo could not bear to meet those eyes for the first moment. Then he nerved himself and glanced at his natural father, the man who had raped his mother and murdered his uncle, the arch-fiend, the demon, the Satanist. Peppino was, even trussed up, a tall and handsome man, and he looked no more nervous than a barrel of wine. "Oh my God," Sigismundo thought, "life is a grand opera to this one. He will die formidable to the end. He will not even beg for mercy."
"It is your decision," Uncle Pietro said to Gina.
"No," Gina said with that look on her face, the look that made Sigismundo want to turn his eyes anywhere else, even at Peppino. "Let Antonio speak. He suffered the most." Everybody glanced at Antonio, who had been normal for months. Now he had the same look as his mother. "A short death is not enough," Antonio said. "We must exercise our ingenuity. It is now about midnight. The pig should not be dead until dawn."
"Wait a minute," Papa Guido said unexpectedly. "We are men, damn it. Certainly this filth must die. The world is not worth living in while such creatures breathe and walk. But torture is vile. Must we go so far?"
"It is Antonio's right to decide," Aunt Gina said bitterly.
"Yes, Antonio must decide. That is the code," Papa said. "But cannot we discuss it first? I say death, yes, absolutely, but not torture. In the name of Jesus and our hope of salvation."
Sigismundo looked again very quickly at his real father to see how Peppino was reacting to this discussion. He looked at the wrong moment because Peppino was looking right at him then, and there was demonic glee as well as contempt in his expression.
"Do it," Peppino said. "Torture your own father. Then your soul will truly belong to the devil forever."
"No," Sigismundo thought. "He is gagged. He did not speak. My imagination is running away with me. I must not think that he spoke directly to the mind, that the power in him is transferring itself to me, that he is literally a demon."
"Dear God, you don't make it easy on us down here."
"I will never speak to any of you again," Aunt Gina was shouting, "if you refuse this. My door will be locked and bolted. I will have no relatives, do you hear? I will regard you not as men of my blood, but strangers. Worse, I will consider you poodles, not men at all, little toy French poodles that have been gelded. Christ Jesus, are there no testicles in the Malatestas anymore?"
"Do it," Peppino's voice said in Sigismundo's head. "Then you will all belong to the devil. This is my sacrament, the devil's mass, the sacrifice of blood, the ritual of hate, and I am a willing victim, so that hate will increase in the world, so that Lucifer will own more of mankind's essence."
"Let me stab him once where it will not kill him," Papa said. "Then I am part of it. I have obeyed the code, but then I will leave. Such abominations as you have in mind are not fit for the eye of God to look upon."
Everybody nodded, one at a time, like automatons at a carnival. Papa had been defeated, so they would be kind to him now.
"We have ethics of a sort," Sigismundo thought wildly, "just as we have human souls, of a sort." Papa grimly took one of the daggers from the wall and walked over to Peppino Bosalmo. "You deserve to die," Papa said, his voice suddenly shrill. "And you excrement, maybe you deserve all the rest that is going to happen to you." Papa's lips were white.
"Wait," Uncle Pietro said. "I agree that Tony decides the punishment. But we are men, as Guido says, and this creature is still a man. Let us give him a chance to pray and repent.
Jesus, no, Sigismundo thought. He did not want to hear what Peppino would say when the gag was removed.
But it was like the church again, time moving slower, as if Zeno's paradox were true and the arrow could never leave the bow. Nobody said anything. Agreement was reached again with slow nods. And in that freeze, Pietro moved very slowly forward and very slowly removed the gag, like a man moving underwater. Like the figure in a nightmare that comes closer and closer in slower and slower motions. Like the man the Dominican preacher spoke of, writing 1, and then 10, and then 100, and then 1,000, and then 10,000, and then 100,000.
Make your peace with God, Pietro said, almost gently.
Whose God? Your rich people's God? Peppino was not even bitter. He seemed to speak with a contempt that had lasted so long it was almost weary. I have a better God, a God who never says, submit, 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 a God who is the bravest and boldest within mankind, a God who says, resist, resist, resist.
You will be dead soon, Pietro said gently. Give up these fantasies. Die with peace.
I shit on peace as long as there are some of you rich and all the rest of us poor. I shit on your God and your mealy-mouthed Jesus and all of you while I am bound and helpless.
Peppino was actually grinning in defiance.
You think Leonardo Malatesta was a big deal in my life? I have arranged thousands of assassinations, you fools. Thousands. And I have not one regret.
Stop him, Aunt Gina screamed.
You'd better stop me, Peppino cried. My God is real, not a myth like yours. He gives me the power. I know all about your sins, you hypocrites. Shall I tell you about the girl you hired in Spain, Signor Celine, and what you made her do?
Papa blanched.
And this noble, long-suffering widow, Peppino leered. Do you want to know what she does to console herself on some lonely nights when she can't sleep without it?
Stop him, Gina screamed again. Stop him!
Papa Guido slashed Peppino across the face, making a thin red line of blood.
Huh, Peppino grunted, but Sigismundo could not tell if it was a cry of pain or of perverse triumph.
Blood was running down Peppino's chin onto his shirt, but he went on.
I have fucked every rich woman I ever met, some with one trick, some with another. And the children, let me tell you, I do not like sodomy much, but teaching it to a little rich boy, knowing he might get to like it and then land in the hands of the Inquisition later.
Antonio leaped forward, panting in rage, and brutally jabbed his dagger into Peppino's right eye. Not deep enough to reach the brain, Sigismundo noticed. Tony still wanted to be sure this would last until morning. Blood was now all over Peppino's shirt and trousers.
You cannot make me scream or cry out, Peppino panted. My God gives me powers you do not understand.
But then he grimaced involuntarily. Thank God, Sigismundo thought. He bleeds. He does feel pain. He is not really a demon.
You are all so noble, so gentle, so fine, Peppino was going on.
Not like us brutal peasants. Your wife asked for more, he said to Papa suddenly. We went at it for hours, like hogs in heat. She couldn't get enough.
He lies, Sigismundo thought. He lies, he lies. I know he lies.
Antonio screamed, no words, just animal rage, and sliced at Peppino's left ear.
I shit on your God, Peppino repeated, beginning at last to look a bit dazed. I shit on the Virgin Mary, he added, blood splattering all over him.
He is running down, Sigismundo thought. He will faint from pain soon.
But Aunt Gina hurled herself forward.
Yes, yes, she screamed. Die with blasphemies. Die damning yourself to an even deeper pit of hell. Go down lower than Judas, pig. Go to the bottom. Curse God some more, please. Make your damnation absolute.
She was kneeling, and for a moment Sigismundo could not understand, would not allow himself to understand, what she was doing.
Antonio was right, he thought. We are in hell all the time. Napoli is just a delusion, a false front. When we see through to the true essence of things, there is nothing but hatred and pain and eternal darkness, and demons howling curses at each other.
Curse God some more, Gina repeated, still hacking at Peppino's crotch.
Her hands were bloody as she threw the testicles to the floor. "Curse God!" she screamed again, hacking at Peppino's penis. Blood was running down both his legs, making a crimson pool on the floor.
"We will get a page in the history books," Sigismundo thought, right after Caligula and the Borgias. "I think I'm dizzy again and not in full possession of my reason."
But certainly, now the worst was over. Even Peppino could not shout more blasphemies with so much blood spurting from so many wounds.
"I fuck your god up the arse," Peppino roared. "I fuck the Virgin Mary and the Pope."
"It will go on forever," Sigismundo thought. "We will go on stabbing him, and he will not die or even faint, because his god is stronger. All history proves it. He will just shout more blasphemies until we are exhausted and have to sleep. And then, when we wake and start again, he will start again too. This is hell. Infinite hatred, eternal fire. We will grow old and gray stabbing him, and we will be filthy with blood. And finally, we will all die of old age. And he will sit there, trussed up in ropes and physically helpless, still defying us." "I'd bugger San Gennaro," Peppino continued ranting, but all Sigismundo could think of was that this man's blood was in him. Demon blood.
"I let him possess me," Peppino shouted. "When there was no Peppino anymore, when there was just Lucifer, then I became invulnerable and free. Free of your laws, your morals, your tyrant god. I am he, and he is me, you fools, don't you see? I will live forever because only in him is freedom from limits."
Papa Guido staggered toward the door.
"No more," he said. "No more, no more."
He stumbled out into the garden. Aunt Gina had blood all over her dress now and was still slashing at Peppino, but in her fury she was stabbing at random now, all over his body. Uncle Pietro seized her and dragged her back.
"Enough," he said. "You will lose your reason if you continue like that."
Sigismundo lurched forward. "My turn. Let me strike one blow and get out of here, like Papa."
Peppino looked at him with his one remaining eye, bloody and inexorable. He could still speak.
"My son," he said, "you will finish my work. It is in the stars."
"No," Sigismundo screamed, but he faltered.
"Yes," Peppino said. "Tana before you, Aradia at your left, Lucifer at your right side."
Sigismundo raised the dagger furiously.
"Orpheus behind you," Peppino concluded. He smiled, as bloody and hideous as the saddest Christ in the most terrible Byzantine crucifixion ever painted, smiled and then even laughed one more time, a laugh like the howl of a hyena, savage and primordial and undefeated, the willing martyr to hatred and rage, the satanic messiah, pure grand opera to the end. The fireworks started again, and Sigismundo went into the crazy space.
"In the name of Emmanuel," Abraham chanted, "I summon your spirit, Sigismundo Cellini, back to this space. In the name of Emmanuel, who is yesterday, today, and the brother of tomorrow."
Sigismundo was signing the parchment with his own blood.
"Now you are mine forever," Peppino said. "Your name is in the book of the devil. You will never rest, no, not for a moment, while there is a single aristocrat alive anywhere in Europe."
"In the name of Emmanuel, whose name means the presence of God is with us, I summon you, Sigismundo Cellini."
Uncle Pietro was splashing water on Sigismundo, bucket after bucket. "I'm being baptized again," Sigismundo thought. They were in the garden by the well. Pietro was tireless, hauling up one bucket after another to dump on Sigismundo's head.
"Libertà!" Peppino's voice shouted from the house.
"What happened?" Sigismundo asked. He felt like the bottom of the junk box in the cellar after the dog had puppies in it.
"You went into a trance," Pietro said, studying him carefully. "Do you know where you are?"
"I am in your garden," Sigismundo said, "and I remember everything, the whole lovely Neapolitan evening, except..."
"Libertà!" came the shout.
"Except what?" Pietro demanded.
"I was about to stab him, and he said something, an invocation, and then..."
"Then you went into the trance," Pietro said.
"Libertà!" screamed the voice of Peppino Bassalmo.
"Jesus," Sigismundo said, "is he yelling that each time they stab him now?"
"Are you really normal again?" Pietro demanded.
"Almost.
I went back in time. No, you didn't. He keyed you with that invocation and you started hallucinating again.
Uncle, you do not know everything. I went back in time. I was in the cave again, under Pompeii, where the Rossi have their Sabbats. Abraham helped me escape and I remembered.
What did you remember?
He made me sign the book. In my own blood, I pledged my soul to the devil.
Listen to me, Pietro said. He gave you a drug that night, belladonna, and he keyed you to remember your hallucinations when he repeated the right words. It's an old trick, drugs and key words. It can make you believe anything if you do not understand that it is only a trick. You do not belong to the devil. You belong to yourself. You have free will.
Libertà!
Christ, 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 Sigismundo cried. Can't they put him out of his misery? Are we as bad as he is?
I know, Pietro said. Do you think I'm proud of any of this?
But it must be this way. In this kingdom, one does not talk to the government about such matters. One handles them personally. It is not the best way, but it is our way, and it is necessary. We were conquered long before the Bourbons, even before the Normans. We may be the most frequently conquered people in the world.
I know all that, Sigismundo interrupted, but
it is terrible what is happening in my living room, Pietro said sadly. I know, I tell you. We are simply a people who have never had a government that was not our enemy. Our code grew up because we had to be our own police and judges and executioners, because the government was never anything but a gang of foreign banditti living on us and exploiting us.
Yes, yes, Sigismundo said. But uncle, torture, castration, Jesus.
I hate it, Pietro said fiercely, but it must be, I tell you. I would rather just give him a drink of poison and be done with it.
But when a people make their own laws and act as their own enforcers, the only way it works is if the injured party decides on the punishment, and if the injured party is half crazy with grief and rage, well, these atrocities happen.
Libertà, 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 came the howl. Pipino was still not dead.
He makes it sound like another of his obscenities, Sigismundo said.
And he is your father, Pietro said with Sophoclean pity. This night will curse us all. At least I can tell you one thing that makes it less abominable. These brothers of mine are amateurs compared to the Dominicans. Pipino will be finished soon because they have already lost their heads. It will not last until dawn, as Antonio wishes.
Libertà! Came the shriek, as if Pipino wanted to assure Sigismundo that Pietro was wrong and he would last for a long time yet.
My God, Sigismundo said, what is he?
He is a man like you and me.
No.
Yes, a man full of hatred, one more product of the terrible history of this tragic kingdom, but still a man.
No, he was born a man, but he made himself something else, as old Abraham or Folly is something else in the opposite direction.
Listen to me carefully, Pietro said solemnly. Abraham was much like Pipino once. So was I.
No.
Yes. To be alone with God, to be naked in the infinity of existence, is how you become like Abraham. There are many traps and pitfalls on that path, and Pipino fell into one of them. He has to be killed like a mad dog, but from the bottom of my heart I pity him.
No.
Listen. There is a path, as you suspect, to the beyond mankind, but it is a path of darkness before it becomes a path of light. The alchemists call it negrito. The witches symbolize it by the black man in their rituals. St. John of the Cross called it the dark night of the soul. It is the chapel perilous of the Grail legend, to which only the perfect fool can be admitted. Do you understand? You have to lose everything, and everything includes what you think you know about God. You may decide there is no God or that God is the spirit of destruction Pipino worships. It is very lonely and very frightening. I speak from experience, not theory. The only difference between Pipino and Abraham is that Pipino never came out the other side. Why do you think he put you in that trance?
To keep control over me, Sigismundo said bitterly, to make one last effort to get me for the Satanists. Maybe. And maybe more. You didn't stab him.
Libertà, Peppino screamed. I will return as millions.
Sigismundo shook his head. You mean he wanted to spare me?
It is possible, Pietro said. He may not repent in any Christian sense. He may blaspheme the Christian God with his last breath, but perhaps he's human enough to want to save you from that unspeakable crime. Patricide. My God, this night has been hell enough for all of us without adding that to the horrors.
I don't believe it, Sigismundo said. Not him. He wants us all to become what he is.
In every human soul, Pietro said, something of God remains. Even if the man denies it and tries with his last moment of consciousness to escape it, it is there. Maybe that is why he used that spell to stop you.
So Satan serves God without knowing it? Sigismundo asked.
That is a Gnostic heresy, Father Ratti says. At least Peppino has stopped screaming about liberty.
You must have been right about the family. They lost their heads and finished him.
But I will never be finished with him, he thought. I will always hear that voice, my true father's voice, telling me to kill every aristocrat in Europe.
Sigismundo did not sleep the rest of that night. He prayed, or tried to pray. Toward the One, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being. Dear God, I can recognize you at times, mostly in music, occasionally in other arts. It comes in brief flashes, but I can see you then as the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty. The trouble is, God, most of the places I see you are tinged with heresy, they tell me. When I try to find you in church, I get lost in the theological spaghetti. Listen, I am only 15 years old. I know that one cannot bargain and haggle with God as with a merchant in the marketplace. I know that is forbidden. Our duty is to accept your mysterious workings and keep our faith no matter what. But I need to bargain and haggle with you. I am terribly confused. Let me tell you, it is not at all easy to find love and harmony and beauty in most of this world. I don't mean to be sarcastic, God, but sometimes it looks as if you're keeping all the love, harmony, and beauty to yourself. What we have in abundance is hate and discord and horror. I almost killed my father tonight, and all that stopped me was a satanic invocation. Please forgive me, God, but I can't help asking, where are you when we need you? I want to tell you, I act like a fool often, and I try to achieve humility and always fail. But God, you don't make it easy on us. I mean, liquefying the blood of San Gennaro is all very well and good, but it just isn't enough anymore. It is too easy to think the priests might be faking it, as the Frenchman said. It would be nice if you would be a little less ambiguous some of the time. I'm not asking much. I know I can't demand anything of you. That would be worse than my other heresies. But I would like to ask, most respectfully, that you help us a little. Aunt Gina had a way with color and fabric that was like a great painter's ability, and tonight I saw her doing abominable things. Now, really, God, she wouldn't have acted that way if you hadn't made the kind of world where women are driven crazy with grief. Please understand me. It has been explained to me many times that these things are not your fault. It is the fault of mankind. But I saw a man mutilated and tortured tonight. And he deserves it if anyone ever did, even if he was my father. But damn it, damn it, damn it, God, I tell you, that scene was not the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty. Not at all, I assure you, on my word of honor as a Christian, it was most unlovely, inharmonious, and unbeautiful. What I don't understand is why you spend so much time torturing your enemies in hell. That's what they tell me. You spend infinities of centuries at infinities of varieties of pain. I can't believe it anymore. It makes you sound crazier than Peppino himself or my poor grief-stricken family when they finally got their hands on him. You know what I think, God? I don't believe they lost their heads at all. They were deceiving themselves. They killed him fairly soon, after all, because the mutilations were making them sick. They wanted to be more monstrous than the monster Balsamo, but they didn't have the hearts for it. So it was all over in less than an hour, I think, although I lost track of time for a while because I was a little crazy again. But you see my problem. If I don't believe in hell, and I don't believe in the Inquisition, and I don't believe all heretics are evil people, then I'm really lost in that selva scura of Dante. I don't know what to believe anymore. For all I know, you aren't even there, and I'm just talking to myself. The Epicureans may be right. There's nothing out there but atoms and the void. And things come out of the void for no reason and go back into the void for no reason. And we invented you because we were lonely. This is terrible, I know. I'm really insulting you now. This is not a prayer at all, but a diatribe. I am ashamed. Honestly, God. But this is still really a prayer, because I need you. If you aren't there, what happened tonight had no more moral significance than a pride of lions devouring a zebra. If you aren't there, we might as well eat Peppino instead of letting the meat go to waste. If you aren't there, what the hell is my music all about? So, give me just one sign, God. Nothing big, nothing dramatic. I keep telling you, I know we aren't supposed to demand such things, but I need a sign, or I don't know what will become of me. And if you can take the time in your busy schedule to liquefy the blood of San Gennaro 2 or 3 times a year, you can slip in one minor revelation for me, please. And one more thing, God. I'm sorry if some of this sounds bitter or ironic. I'm under a lot of strain right now. It's not every boy who gets to see his father castrated and murdered, you know. Toward dawn, he finally dozed a while, and woke up gagging with a half-dream still possessing him. Blood on his hands, blood on his nightshirt, on the bedsheets, on everything, a rising ocean of blood. There was no time to bolt down the stairs to the Jakes. He hauled out the chamber pot and vomited, again and again and again, visions of blood circling around and around in his head. Negrito, he remembered. The alchemists call it the blackening of the first matter. Part 4. The Priestess. For mercy has a human heart, pity a human face, and love the human form divine, and peace the human dress. William Blake, The Divine Image. At first, Maria Maldonado was aware of Sigismundo Cellini. Only in the vague, half-annoyed way you become conscious of a bug crawling on your neck. It had begun when she was 13. Napoli was, of course, full of faces of people who were not close friends of the noble Maldonados, faces that she could associate somewhat confidently with family names. He looks like an Orsini. Isn't she one of the Portinaris? That sort of thing. But there was one face that she began to notice more than the others in the amorphous cloud of the half-identified. This one special, annoyingly special face was constantly appearing at the periphery of her vision. She would catch it staring at her in the most intense manner possible, as a knight might stare at the Grail, she thought. But then it would look away, furtively and guiltily, when their eyes almost met. It was the face of a good-enough-looking boy, about her own age probably. Short and stocky like most Neapolitans, with a ridiculous little beard he no doubt considered debonair. He must be an extraordinarily stupid boy, maybe feeble-minded, because he was always tripping over things or banging his head on the signs outside stores. Only gradually did she realize that he was not exactly a half-wit, but, strangely, that there was something about herself that made him abnormally nervous. That was why, when she caught him staring at her in that peculiarly obsessive way, his mouth was often open. It wasn't that he was short of brains, like the poor Orsini boy with a huge head, who could not speak and lounged about with his mouth open. This Cellini nitwit could not breathe properly when she looked at him simply because he was acutely, painfully shy. It was a long time before she realized that this clumsy and clownish youth was in love with her. She began to understand that when she started reading novels. Of course, the nuns at St. Theophobia Convent School in Roma were hell on novels. You could catch the very devil if they found you with one. Still, all the other girls read them, and Maria found some of them quite exciting, actually, even if the ardent characters in them, allegedly adult, reminded her more of her younger brothers and sisters than any adults she had met in the real world. But there was no doubt about it. Men in novels, when they were in love, acted exactly like that absurd boy who kept trailing her around Napoli every summer when she was home on holiday. Unfortunately, the novels did not tell you what you should do when you were not yourself madly in love with a male who was suffering these melodramatic symptoms. It was more than a nuisance by then. It was a continuous irritation, like her brother Carlo and his incessant target practice. Bang, 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 guns firing all summer long, enough to drive you to distraction. Mother Ursula, the abbess, had a class on Saturdays for especially promising girls. Maria was a member. The girls were encouraged to ask questions concerning just about anything, and Mother Ursula would tell them how to find the answers for themselves, usually, or when the subject was not very nice and a bit embarrassing, she would answer in full, and in a way that got rid of the embarrassment. Generally, she sent the girls on a search for their own answers because, as she often said, "I am here to set your brains in motion. It profits nobody if I just keep pouring my words into your ears until they start overflowing out of your mouths without any real mental activity on your part." One day, it was a Sunday after Mass in the garden, Maria mustered up the courage to ask Mother Ursula about Sigismondo Cellini. "And how do you feel about him?" Mother Ursula asked. "I think he's terrible," Maria said bluntly. "Of course," Mother Ursula said, "but that is because he makes you feel terrible. His obsession is annoying because you are intelligent enough to know that it is more or less accidental. If it wasn't you, he would have some other girl to be obsessed with. That is the way it is with boys his age." Maria nodded, a bit unsurely. "He makes me realize what other men probably think when they look at my body." "Yes," Mother Ursula said. "Now listen closely, my child. A few girls in this college may decide to give themselves to Christ, as I have, but most of you will eventually be married off to men of the correct social rank. You will be expected to have children. That means that you will have sexual union with your husband often. Don't fidget like that. This is a sacrament ordained by God to perpetuate humanity. I am going to be even more blunt. In the early years of marriage, this will probably occur many times a week. 5 times, 7 times, maybe more. Later, when the children start arriving, there will be more distractions, more responsibilities, and this will happen less often. But you will still have it after marriage, for the rest of your life. How does that make you feel?" "I'm frightened," Maria said. Even Mother Ursula seldom spoke this frankly. "Of course you are," Mother Ursula said. "But look into yourself honestly and be honest with me. Haven't you on occasion had somewhat romantic feelings about certain men? Be honest," Mother Ursula repeated. Maria felt herself blushing. "I thought," she said awkwardly, "sometimes it would be nice to have Giancarlo Tannoni fall in love with me. I've thought of him kissing me and well, saying he couldn't live without me." "You have been reading novels," Mother Ursula said, smiling. "All the girls here read novels." "I read novels too," she said secretively. "The other nuns would be horrified if they knew. Every age has some new art form that is supposed to be a threat to morals and civil order. In our time, it happens to be novels. The human race has survived all such innovations. However, I will now tell you 5 things about this Signor Tannoni, whom I have never met. He is at least 50. He is the best in his trade, whatever trade that is. He has a wife and several children. He is a man of honor and will not be unfaithful to his wife. He is brave and also kindly. Am I wrong in any respect?" Maria felt as if Mother Ursula might be a Stregia in disguise. "How do you do it?" she asked nervously. "It is easy," Mother Ursula said, smiling again. "That is a rough description of the man I was in love with at your age. It is the kind of man nice girls always have fantasies about. Do you know why? Because he is safe. You know it is all a fantasy. If you started having such thoughts about a boy your own age, you would frighten yourself. Do you understand?" Maria nodded. She was too petrified to speak. "Sin is a terrible thing," Mother Ursula said gravely, "but God is very wise and very forgiving. Wise and more forgiving than most people here in Roma, or back in Napoli. The sin that you are afraid of, so afraid that you are even embarrassed to think of it, is more hated by men than by God. Do you know why? Because essentially marriage is a property transaction. The buyer wants undamaged goods. It is all male prejudice. That is why this silly, insignificant kind of sin is regarded as more terrible than murder, which is the kind of sin God really hates. Mother Ursula took Maria's hand. I was married once, she said. I gave myself to Christ only after my husband was killed in an accident at sea. Let me tell you something about sexual intercourse. This time she was absolutely not going to let Maria avoid the idea by veiling it in euphemisms. That can be the most beautiful part of marriage. Usually it is not. It is the chief source of resentments, angers, and even violence. This is because both men and women are ignorant. You will be married in a few years, Maria. Come to me often with all your questions and anxieties on this subject. There is no reason why you should enter adulthood in fear and ignorance, just because the church happens to be run by males who are full of fear and ignorance. Maria had never heard anything like that before, and she realized Mother Ursula was taking a certain risk in talking so bluntly. Of course, Mother Ursula was not quite like any other nun. For one thing, she had long engaged in correspondence with Maria Gaetana Agnesi, who lectured at the University of Milano on such topics as conic sections and analytical geometry, and was something of an expert on hydraulic systems, subjects in which women were not supposed to be competent. And Mother Ursula had also corresponded with Signora Mazzolini, who taught anatomy and actually handled male bodies at the University of Bologna, and with the incredible Laura Bassi of the same university, who taught natural philosophy and how to use a telescope, and was accused of the heresies of Galileo and Newton. Mother Ursula said that women could do anything men could do, and someday they might even be priests or bishops, although she did not say the last part in public. The Dominicans would be sure to swoop down on the convent like weasels on a chicken yard if that opinion were ever broadcast publicly, Maria knew. So that if Maria learned a great deal about marriage and reproduction from Mother Ursula, and even learned to use the ghastly word penis without blushing in their private discussions, she also learned many other things, beyond the musical skills and embroidery that were considered proper for girls. She learned that women had once owned property in Sparta and Egypt, for instance, and that geometry was not impossible at all, but actually quite interesting, and showed you how to think accurately, and that there had been women judges in Babylon, and that the further north you went, the more people despised the Inquisition and wished it abolished, and that you could analyze music mathematically, as Pythagoras had discovered, thereby showing that even something as mysterious as beauty had a rational foundation. The most amazing thing about Mother Ursula, however, was revealed to Maria only when Hercules took ill. Hercules was one of the mules the school owned to pull the carts for their trips into the hills to study botany. The local horse doctor was called, and he examined Hercules carefully, then gave the beast a purgative. It is something he ate, he said. Whether he will live or die, I cannot say. It depends on how much of the toxin is in his blood already. Maria was very fond of Hercules because he was the most intelligent mule she had ever known and had very sad, weary, contemplative eyes, as if he had figured out long ago that being a mule was mostly hard work and offered little reward. She went out to the stable a few hours after the horse doctor left, hoping that Hercules would be recovering as a result of the purgative. Mother Ursula was in the stable before her and was kneeling, as if in prayer, but her hands were not clasped. She was holding them over Hercules' body, about 6 inches from each side of his head. Maria hesitated in the doorway, not sure of what she was seeing, and just then Mother Ursula said, half aloud and half to herself, "It is finished. Heal." Maria jumped back, almost terrified, as Hercules lumbered to his feet. She couldn't have been more surprised if the sad-eyed beast had followed that feat by singing the oratorio for Easter. "That's right," Mother Ursula was saying, tickling the mule's ears and patting his head. "You deserve to live. You are God's child, too." And Hercules was frisking and playing as if he had never been ill at all. Then Mother Ursula became aware of Maria in the doorway. "My prayer was answered," she said simply. "You did it," Maria blurted. "You are a saint, aren't you?" Nonsense, Mother Ursula said sharply. God did it. Don't talk heresy, child.
Maria rushed forward and grasped the abbess's hands. As she expected, they were warm and tingling.
God did it, she repeated, of course. But you were God's vehicle. I can feel the power in your hands.
I wasn't even here, Mother Ursula said. If I had been here, it couldn't have happened. All praise should go to God.
Maria did not perfectly understand that, but she did know that Papa sometimes talked about an uncle, long dead now, who could do healings of that sort.
You could feel the power in his hands, Papa would say. That was why Maria had grasped the abbess's hands, to check that. Every village had a healer with that talent, to judge by stories the other girls told. Such healers had to be very careful and very discreet to avoid troubles with the Dominicans' committee to theologically investigate claims of the unusual, who usually decided it was witchcraft.
How do you do it? Maria asked, enthralled.
I don't do it, Mother Ursula said. I just go away, and God does it. And never again accuse me of being a saint. That could lead me to the very serious sin of vanity, and if it were repeated, it might even lead some of the other nuns to the sin of envy. That is why our Lord says, Let not thy right hand know what thy left hand doeth. And that was that. Mother Ursula absolutely refused to allow the subject to be mentioned again. Maria did not guess even then why Mother Ursula gave her such special attention. But Hercules was perfectly well from that day onward and never had a relapse, and every time Maria looked at the baffled, intelligent eyes of the animal, she thought of that strange kind of healing. She had to agree, of course, that God did it. That was theologically correct. But God didn't do it just for anyone. He didn't do it for the horse doctor, for instance. You had to be a special person with the capacity to be not there, as Mother Ursula called it, so God could work through you. Maria remembered two times she herself had been not there. Once, at home in the garden, she was looking at a very special kind of butterfly. She didn't know its name because it was a species she had never seen before. Just then, Carlo fired a gun at the other end of the estate, shooting at targets as usual. Suddenly, there was only the butterfly. There was no Maria looking at it. It was a wonderful experience, but she was always afraid to talk about it to anyone, because she had her first period that evening and she always thought it was some kind of strain that had unhinged her mind for a minute. That was when she was 12 and didn't know Mother Ursula yet. The second time had occurred when she was 15. Papa had taken the whole family to the Teatro San Carlo to hear an oratorio by a German named Handel called the Messiah. Near the end, there was a chorus made up of the one word, Hallelujah, repeated over and over and over in counterpoint, and suddenly Maria was not there again. There was just the voices and the joy and, it seemed, God himself singing in each of the voices. And no Maria. It was as if space had been abolished and time stretched out to infinity. And sure enough, she had her period that night too, and still did not understand. And then a few months after her talk with Mother Ursula about that repulsive Celline boy, and a week or so after the healing of Hercules, came the incident of the peasant's cart. Classes were finished for the day, and Maria was in her room studying for the test in religious knowledge. She was reviewing some Bible text and came to Matthew chapter 10, verse 7. And when he had called unto him his 12 disciples, he gave them the power against unclean spirits to cast them out, and to heal all manner of sickness and all manner of disease. Maria idly wondered, if all 12 had the power, and they passed it on to so many others, the early history of the church was full of stories of miracle healings. Why had it become so atrophied in later centuries? Why did only a few have it now, such as Mother Ursula and the, usually ignorant, healers among the peasants? But then the next verse struck her. And he said, As ye go, preach. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. Heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, raise the dead, cast out devils. Freely ye have received, freely give. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. That was what Jesus, the Son of God, had said. And yet 1,766 years had passed,
and the kingdom had not manifested. It was heresy to think that Jesus had lied, or even that he had made a mistake. Was it possible that the kingdom of heaven was at hand all the time, and we had only to open ourselves to receive it, the way Mother Ursula opened herself to let God heal Hercules through her? Freely ye have received. But suppose you did not know what you had received. That would explain why the kingdom was not manifest to us. Were we like an ignorant man who has 1,000,000 florins buried in his cellar and doesn't know about it? That was when she heard the crash and the scream. When she raced downstairs, all the girls were rushing out to the gate toward the road. The nuns, who had been praying in the chapel at the other end of the college, were far behind the crowd. As Maria came through the gate, the Portinari girl from Firenze came back from the road, white-faced, and turned to vomit in a corner behind the rose bushes. Puke and red roses, Maria thought. It was like the design of an artist gone demoniac. But then she braced herself. Someone had been hurt, and the mature thing to do was to try to help, not to stagger off and get sick like a child. She stepped into the road. A peasant was lying in a pool of blood. Roses and gore, the crimson of beauty and the crimson of agony. Stop thinking like that. There was a wheel off his cart. Obviously, the wheel had come loose and he had been thrown sideways, banging his head badly on the cobblestones. Maria felt tears rushing to her eyes, but then instead of weeping, she just opened again, as she had during the Hallelujah chorus. Freely ye have received, freely give. She rushed forward and knelt by the fallen man, tearing her petticoat to make a bandage for the wound. But she was also thinking, heal, heal. If I go away, God can do it. Let me go away. Let God come in. His wife and children need him. It is a hard life for peasants. Heal, heal. Let your mercy flow through me. Mother Ursula was suddenly standing beside her. Beatrice, she said to one of the girls. Run as fast as you can to Via Dante and get the doctor. Then she knelt beside Maria, looking at the man's face. His breath is coming back, she said. Somebody dip some rags in the well and bring them here. Maria put both hands over the bandage, as if straightening it. She could feel the tingling power in her fingers. She looked nervously at Mother Ursula. You are doing fine, Mother Ursula said. Then for the others she added, It was very cool and intelligent to make a bandage so quickly. Jesus, the peasant said vaguely. Hush, Mother Ursula told him. You will be all right. Just rest and don't try to get up. I have to go to market, he said. No, you don't, Mother Ursula said calmly. That will be attended to eventually. You just have to rest now. Who did it? He asked. What fatherless one hit me? Rest, Mother Ursula repeated. The peasant closed his eyes again. He was breathing normally, like a man going to sleep at night. And when Dr. Mazzini arrived, he was astonished. With a wound like that, he said, looking extremely perplexed. He should have bled to death, even with your makeshift bandage. Very strange. Well, God's mercies are mysterious. Isn't that what you would say, Mother Abbess? The peasant survived. And a few weeks later, he came to the gate of the school and insisted on donating a big barrel of fresh tomatoes and peppers. And Maria finally understood that she had the power too. So it was no surprise when Mother Ursula invited her to take a walk in the garden again. There are many superstitions in the world, Mother Ursula said. Maria had known it would begin like that. If people see certain things, the abbess went on, they are very quick to jump to conclusions. Some, especially the young and innocent, may say that the person who does these things is a saint. Maria blushed. That is always wrong. Nobody is a saint until the church infallibly says so, and that can happen only long after the person's death, and there must be extensive investigation, as you know. So it does no good to talk of such things, and it leads to vanity. On the other hand, there are more dangerous superstitions. Anybody can be accused of being a stregia, you know, even the daughter of the great Count Maldonado. Maria nodded. We must be merciful, Mother Ursula said softly. If we can help others, it is our duty to do so, But in this wicked world we must also be, as our Lord said, gentle as doves and subtle as serpents, like the fabulous Rosicrucians, who probably do not exist at all outside of legend. We must figuratively wear the garb of the country and adopt its customs. We should not stand out at all. Ostentatious display of the power is not only vanity, but folly. Do you understand? It can be extremely dangerous. Maria turned and confronted the abbess directly.
You don't think the inquisitors are very bright, do you? She asked bluntly. You are saying that even harmless people can be condemned by them.
Mother Ursula smiled tiredly. Read the life of Joan of Arc, she said. Then tell me if you think Joan was really a witch, as the inquisitors claimed. And Maria knew that whomever Papa married her off to, whatever else happened in her life, her days would not be those of an ordinary Neapolitan contessa.
Part 5. The World.
The great and direct end of government is liberty. Secure our liberties and privileges, and the end of government is answered. If this be not effectively done, government is an evil. Patrick Henry, Speech Against the U.S. Constitution, June 25, 1788. All at once, I felt myself dazzled by a thousand sparkling lights. I realized that man is by nature good, and that only our institutions have made him bad. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Letter to Malesherbes, January 12, 1762. All of Napoli awoke one morning to learn that a horribly mutilated corpse of a tall blonde man was hanging from a tree in the Piazza Medaglia d'Oro. On its chest was a scroll saying, "So perish all the Rossi." The police pronounced themselves mystified by the atrocity. Sigismundo assumed that Uncle Pietro and his friend Drake had pulled the right strings and greased the right palms to guarantee that the police would officially remain mystified forever. And so, he told himself, the worst was over. Other Rossi were still out there, somewhere, plotting and scheming, his half-brother among them. But things would never be as they were when Peppino Basalmo was alive. Whatever malice they possessed, however violent their aims, the other Rossi were only human beings and did not have cloven hooves. There could not be another one like Peppino. And maybe, Sigismundo thought, God will not be insulted by my frantic prayer last night. Maybe he will send me a sign that he really is there and that I wasn't just talking to the atoms and the void. So when he was returning from classes that afternoon and took his shortcut through the alley off Piazza Bellini, he was not so much frightened as outraged, almost furious at what he saw. This is my answer, he thought. This is the sign. God wants me to know he doesn't give a hoot in hell about any of us down here. Because a figure had stepped out of a doorway ahead of him. It had drawn a dagger. It was waiting. That is precisely the final horror, he thought, that there is no final horror, that it goes on and on and on. For there was no mistaking that face, those dark Sicilian eyes with a touch of violet in them. Sigismundo quite forgot his nausea at the memories of last night's butchery, his vomiting into the Jordan until he could vomit no more. Right now he wanted more blood. He had been pushed to his limit. He had his sword, he had his training, and at this moment he had a good share of his father's fury. I will slice the bastard to a million pieces, he thought, and feed his nose to my dog when I get home. But then, by the sheer power of Tononi's training, automatically, he looked behind him, almost unconscious that he was checking the path of retreat, if retreat were necessary. Plan for everything, Tononi said, and count on nothing. Two men had stepped out of another doorway behind him. Like his half-brother in front, they were not hooded, but their clothes were solid black. They wanted him to make a connection and identify them as Rossi. and of course their daggers were already drawn. Sigismundo unsheathed his sword, unable to feel even a twinge of fear because he was overwhelmed by blind fury, at God, at the order of nature, at whatever it was that kept doing these things to him. 3 against 1 it was, and 2 of them behind him. It didn't matter. He would almost certainly die. It didn't matter. He was going to hack and slash and chop as long as he had even one arm left to wield the sword, not against these 3 alone, but against it, God, the order of nature, whatever tormented him continually from behind the scenes, against the stars themselves if they were the forces that had elected him to this damnable destiny. Sigismundo's brother approached. He was smiling. I will kill him at last, Sigismundo thought. I am good enough for that, even with 2 at my back. Young Balsamo charged. Sigismundo lunged with his sword, a perfect thrust. Tononi would be proud of him, and, he could not believe it, he missed entirely. And spinning around, trying to understand, he saw that his brother had run past him, not at him, and that the other 2 were running also, 3 black figures looking almost like crows as they vanished around a corner. Sigismundo, panting, incredulous, looked about. There were no policemen on the horizon. There was nobody outside any of the houses at all. If anything moved, it was as unobtrusive as a pickpocket's fingers. The Rossi had not been frightened off. They had not planned to harm him at all. He wanted to scream in rage. He wanted to run his sword through the first cat that moved on the street. He wanted to dash into the nearest church and denounce God from the altar. So he merely resheathed his sword, breathed the relaxing breath Abraham had taught him, and, when that did not work immediately, turned and kicked a rock. This was what he had feared in San Francesco di Paolo last Easter, when his life had been spared the first time. The oldest, the most vicious Sicilian trick of all, we could have killed you, but we didn't. Now it was just a matter of waiting. They might be back tomorrow or next week, or they might wait a year. They might even box him in again and let him go again, cat and mouse. Sometimes, if this technique were sufficiently prolonged, some men actually went looking for them, to beg for mercy or to offer a deal, any deal they wanted. Take my daughter, some had said after a few of these visitations, or take 50% of my business, or whose throat do you want me to slit? And, of course, everybody knew it. Sometimes when you got to that point and went to them to beg and plead, it turned out that they didn't want anything except to kill you. They simply liked you to know you were a coward and a fool, going to them almost on your knees while they waited like spiders to devour you. I wish they had attacked, he thought, even though I was outnumbered. But if I could fight and miraculously win, or even if I could fight and die, at least it would be over. But now it will go on as long as they desire. And it makes no difference if the Inquisition or the secret police somehow catch this group. A Sicilian vendetta never ends. If they all hang in the public square or burn at the stake, the men who will replace them are already picked. My name is on their list. There was the story everybody had heard about the landlord who was particularly cruel, monstrous even for Sicily. And the mafia got him one day, 4 of them, and carried him to a cliff. They held his legs and dangled him over the abyss. It was said that they held him that way, upside down, like the hanged man in the tarot, and never spoke a word, never answered his pleas and his screams. It went on for 10 minutes, which must have seemed like an hour to the landlord, waiting to die, and then they abruptly hauled him up again and set him on the ground alive. At last, one of the mafia men spoke, 1 sentence only, and then they all vanished. The landlord could not stand up straight and walk home for nearly 2 hours, it was said. The mafia man had said, "Next time, we let go." The landlord killed himself a month later, went out to his barn and took a gun, and put it in his mouth and blew the back of his head off. He could not stand 1 more day of waiting for next time. Sigismundo breathed the relaxing breath again and invoked the 4 archangels. There are people like Abraham, he reminded himself. The world does not consist entirely of monsters battling monsters. When he got home, he went at once to his room. Playing the clavicembalo, any tune would do right now, would certainly help calm him. And then, as if he had found a five-legged horse, he saw it. Beautiful, he thought. I must admire the artistic restraint of this. So nicely inconspicuous and understated, but still as hard to ignore as a cobra in the bedsheets. It was only a book, but it was very old, and it was not one of his books. Somehow he knew it was not a gift from a friend, that he should be afraid of it. Sigismundo walked over to the table and picked it up, wondering if it might explode like a bomb. They are doing a nice job, he thought, in making me see threats everywhere. The Key of Solomon, it said, and close up he saw that it was even older than he had thought from across the room. I wonder if they informed the Inquisition, he thought. The Dominicans might be at the front door right now to investigate a report that I own a copy of the most infamous black magic grimoire in Europe. He took the book between two fingers and carried it out onto the veranda. There was a potted palm balanced on bricks so the excess moisture could run out of the bottom after it was watered. Not the cleverest hiding place in the world, but it would have to do for a while. He inserted the book between the bricks under the pot. He sat down on the swing chair and thought. It did not fly in the window, he told himself. I may be the most perfect approximation of pure idiocy since Quixote, but I am not simple enough to believe that. Somebody put it there. They did not just walk into the house and put it in my room and walk out again, all without being seen. They are human and palpable. He went looking for the upstairs maid, Carlotta, and found her dusting in Papa's study. Carlotta, did somebody deliver a package for me? Yes, master. She looked frightened. I must control my face. Don't scare the wits out of the servants. Breathe slowly. Did you take it? Yes, master. The true peasant. She would never say more than was directly asked. It was a book? Yes, master. Thank God she can't read. She has no idea she was handling something people have been burned for owning. The man who delivered it, Sigismundo said easily, was he a Siciliano? No, master. What did he look like then? A tall man, very dark, a great hawk nose. Frankenstein. No, I mean the man who pretends to be Frankenstein. He isn't really Frankenstein. Just as my father isn't really my father, and the Carbonari are not necessarily the real Carbonari, and the miracles of San Gennaro may be a fake, and nothing is for sure or certain anywhere. Sigismundo returned to his room and then to the veranda. Mama was trimming flowers in the garden, singing softly to herself. Nobody else was outside. He looked over both shoulders anyway. One can't be too careful these days. He slipped the book out of the bricks inside his cloak. Like a thief in my own house, he thought. He breathed again, counting backward. It was a beautiful Neapolitan day. The sun was low on the horizon, and the bay was turning green as fast as a peasant girl's wedding ring. The plants in the garden were lush and fat, like bishops or any other creatures that get fed without having to hunt or work. Uncle Pietro, for all his cynicism about local moors, agreed there was no city in Europe more beautiful than Napoli. There may be no city in the world with as many splendid views, Sigismundo thought. I wonder if I should hire a food taster. He slipped back into his room and began exploring the Key of Solomon. Many geometrical figures, a scattering of Hebrew words, the basic text in Latin. Then he noticed the book plate in the front. Ex Libris. Johann de Pell von Frankenstein. Schloss Frankenstein. Frankenstein am Rhein. The real Frankenstein, he reminded himself, had died in 1734. This was all an elaborate hoax. Of course. He did not get out of his grave and come to Napoli to haunt me because of something the stars say. Besides, astrology is a heresy, like the doctrine of toleration, or the idea that flaming rocks fall out of the sky. No, even alchemists do not climb out of their graves. Unless there had been a gypsy switch, like in the three-card Monte game, and they had buried the wrong man. Next, I would be looking under the bed for crocodiles.
Sigismundo rummaged about in the closet and found an old shirt. He used it to wrap the book, making a bundle that showed no square edges. He quickly went down the outside stairs to the garden.
"Lovely day," Mama said.
"Yes, God be praised," he answered.
He threw the bundle into the incinerator. Lorenzo, the gardener handyman, would burn it that night.
No Dominicans came to the house that evening, so Sigismundo thought having me arrested by the Inquisition is not the game the Rossi intend. The next morning he woke with the sun in his face and larks singing in the garden. He felt his chin. The beard was becoming more luxuriant every day. "I am becoming a man," he thought. "I have the brains and the balls to deal with whatever is coming at me. I am almost 16. I haven't hallucinated in months, except when they were torturing Peppino." Then he looked at his writing table. The key of Solomon was back. And for some reason he remembered his crazy father's dying words. "Libertà, I will return as millions."
Sigismundo thought of Schloss Frankenstein, Castle Frankenstein. It got that name because Stein means mountain as well as rock in German, and the Franks held that mountain as a fortress in the 9th century, about the same time we Malatestas were made governors of the Western Empire by Charlemagne. Always build your castle on a high mountain. That was the first rule of survival in those days. And 100 years ago, almost yesterday in that perspective, Tippel von Frankenstein had lived in that castle, conducting forbidden experiments. And he is still walking around, or somebody is going to a great deal of trouble to make me think he is still walking around. Sigismundo looked at the book of magic that had apparently come back out of the void. If Epicurus was right, the book was made out of atoms. When the book burned, the atoms weren't destroyed, merely restructured. Sigismundo tried to imagine an act of will that would cause the atoms to return to their original structure and form the book again. It was a weird thought, like that macabre passage in Shakespeare about the atoms of a king being eaten by a worm, that was eaten by a fish, that was eaten by a peasant, thereby proving a king can pass through the intestines of a serf. And a book could come back out of the void, and Antonio and I did travel backward in time, and a dead man came to the door yesterday, and the Pope does have feathers. If you didn't believe in hell or the Inquisition, you were not really a Catholic anymore. Faith was shattered, and you had to figure out the universe one piece at a time. Maybe one man's will had caused a book to reform itself out of the void after being reduced to ashes. Or maybe they simply had two copies of the book. He laughed out loud. The essence of the human soul above the animal and vegetable was reason. The square and the level and all the other symbols of Uncle Pietro's club were implements of the rational mind. Sigismundo dressed rapidly, rushed through his washing, and went to the garden. He found Lorenzo collecting manure from the hut where they kept the family mule.
"Good morning, Lorenzo."
"Good morning, master." Lorenzo removed his hat and smiled, then looked at the ground. "Did you find a book in the garbage last night?"
"Oh, yes, master." Lorenzo smiled more broadly. "I knew it must be a mistake, so I returned it to your room."
A victory for the square and the level. The universe was rational after all.
"That was very observant of you, Lorenzo," Sigismundo said.
"A 1,000 thanks.
"You are welcome, master."
Sigismundo returned to his room, wondering why that master business was beginning to get on his nerves. All his life the servants had called him master. It was always "si, signor," or "no, signor," or "grazie, signor." It was something that had always been part of his world, like Vesuvius smoldering up there like a wounded dragon that might belch fire again any time. But now it was all different. What would Lorenzo think? What would any of the servants think if they knew he was half-peasant himself, a half-Sicilian on top of it? Would they say "signor" in exactly the same tone then? And even if they did, what would they say to each other behind his back? Alone in his bedroom, Sigismundo succumbed to temptation. He opened the Key of Solomon and began browsing. The geometric diagrams he had noticed last evening concerned magical circles. First you were supposed to draw a circle on the floor, then put one of these diagrams, pentagon or octagon or whatever, inside it, then use the proper incenses or perfumes, then recite a formula, and then an angel or a demon would appear. Sigismundo read an invocation to summon Set and Beelzebub and 75 lesser demons to unleash them upon an enemy. "I do not believe in hell anymore," he reminded himself. "I wonder, though, if I'm so far gone in skepticism that I would dare to try this, confident that it is all nonsense and 77 demons would not appear." The answer was clear. He was still enough of a Catholic not to want to experiment upon summoning devils. Besides, he thought, who knows what's in those incenses and perfumes? You can certainly summon demons with belladonna. Demons real enough to haunt you for weeks or months afterward. He remembered Abraham saying, during one of their conversations, "Magic is just the art of changing the focus of consciousness at will." With drugs and repetitious chants, Antonio and Sigismundo had both experienced such shifts in focus. It could even be done by ritual alone. A cripple had walked out of the cathedral healed only a few months ago, after a solemn high mass. Dr. Vico said every country was a group of people living in a common myth. Uncle Pietro said every club had its own myth. If every myth is a metaphor, as Vico also claimed, then the key was just a system to experiment with alternative metaphors. Sigismundo stopped himself at that thought. "I will end up committing worse heresies than the Alumbrados if I'm not careful," he thought. Turning the pages at random, he found detailed instructions on how to create a homunculus. This passage was heavily underlined, and Sigismundo visualized De Pell von Frankenstein 90-some years ago, reading it with great excitement. But that was not the man who came to the door yesterday. It couldn't be. "First you must procure warm horse manure," the key said, "and place it in a hermetically sealed jar. At the full moon, add to it your own sperm." This is the sin of Onan, Sigismundo thought. Black magic indeed. "Every 7 days, for 7 times 7 days, add more fresh sperm. On the 50th day at dawn, a transparent wraith will appear above the jar. Feed this with fresh blood every day for 21 more days. It will then become solid and grow into a man." Sigismundo slammed the book shut. Enough. Now I know how Frankenstein created that creature they still tell monstrous tales about in Bavaria. It is not well to know such things. This book definitely comes from one of the more unsavory clubs. And somebody, not Frankenstein himself, that was impossible, wanted him to have this kind of knowledge. Because of the bloody stars and their damnable messages about him. Sigismundo was very observant on his way to college that day. He saw no Rossi. And coming home in the afternoon, it was the same. But of course he had known that the second visitation would be very nicely calculated to come when he least expected it. He had thought they would assume he would expect a long delay before the second visit, so he had guessed they would come again very soon to shock him. But they had guessed that he would think that way, and hence they were waiting. It was a game of torture with all the exquisite subtleties of chess strategy. The Dominican at the retreat was right about one thing, Sigismundo thought. This world is a monstrous place, and the only way to catch even a glimpse of God is to withdraw from it entirely, as the cloistered orders do. But that would not work for me. I would be in my cell one day meditating and trying to find union with the divine, and a knife would come through the window and whiz past my throat to plunk into a wall. To remind me, they never forget. A Sicilian vendetta never ends. They have their own mad sense of balance, he thought. I am being tortured in a more refined way than Peppino was tortured. It has its own delicacy, this Sicilian revenge. Measure for measure in their account book. But that evening, something else was afoot in the Celline household. Mamma was busy in the kitchen supervising the cook, which meant that this was going to be a special dinner. And Papa had a look that Sigismundo read easily. There was a surprise in store for somebody. Then Uncle Pietro and Aunt Violetta arrived. At a glance, Sigismundo knew they were in on the secret. When the servants brought in the antipasto, Sigismundo knew this was a very special occasion. Diced octopus and prosciutto and black Greek olives along with the usual peppers and cheeses. Aunt Violetta typically dominated the conversation, and therefore they all talked almost entirely about novels. Either Aunt Violetta had never heard the Malatesta motto about a time to talk and a time to be silent, or she simply didn't believe it. She had always declared that there was nothing wrong with novels, no matter what the Dominicans said, and she read even more of them than Mama did. She read them in English and French, as well as Italian, and refused to believe they were inferior to the classics. She often said that some of the novels would be classics themselves someday, which, to most educated people, was like saying a monkey might be a man someday. Tonight, Violetta was especially keen on something called The Castle of Otranto by some Englishman named Walpole. "It positively scared the blue hell out of me," she said, "but all the time I was enjoying it, I kept asking myself why I enjoyed being frightened. I decided it was because I knew, really, that it wasn't real." Aristotle had a different theory about why we enjoy being frightened, Uncle Pietro offered. "You mean that catharsis idea?" Aunt Violetta asked. "Well, that's true enough, but only when we know it isn't real, as I was just saying. Nobody enjoys a real catharsis." "I am not enjoying mine," Sigismundo thought. Aunt Violetta had ordered the Castle of Otranto from London. "God only knows when there will be an Italian translation," she said. "Probably in 100 years, if all the Dominicans go away." "Be careful," Papa said. "They don't care what women say," Aunt Violetta replied. "They don't even know we exist most of the time." It was after antipasto and pasta and salad during the meat course, beef in the French style, that Papa made his announcement. "We have decided," he announced, "that this year I will go to London and Paris to sell our wines, not Pietro. And you, Sigismundo, will accompany me." "But," Sigismundo objected, "this was too good to be true. Escape from Napoli, from Rossi, and witches and conspiracies and black magic and the maybe-dead, maybe-Frankenstein character." "I know," Papa said genially. "The college. We have discussed this already with the rector. He agrees. Such a trip will be more educational than keeping you in school at this point. You are ridiculously far ahead of your classmates in most subjects." Sigismundo felt his ears reddening. "Thank you, Papa," he said awkwardly. "I will reread every play of Shakespeare's," he was thinking. "My English will be perfect when we get off the boat." After dinner, Sigismundo asked if Uncle Pietro would come to his room to look at something he had written about the theory of harmony. Everybody accepted that at face value. If Pietro suspected more, his face did not show it. When they were alone in Sigismundo's room, Pietro revealed at once what his face had not confessed. "Is it only harmony?" he asked, "or something not so aesthetic?" Sigismundo hauled the Key of Solomon out from under the potted palm on the veranda. He told the whole story of the last 2 days in a whisper, of course. "Well," Pietro said, "I congratulate you on several points. Especially, I congratulate you on deducing how the book got back and checking your reasoning against the evidence by going and asking Lorenzo. Do you think the Rossi will kill me?" "No," Pietro said at once. "They may frighten you in 1,000 cruel ways, come up with more bluffs than 1,000,000 card players, but they will never really harm you, at least not kill you. They really believe you were born to lead them. Never, never, never forget that. The terror cannot destroy you if you remember that these men are limited by their belief in that astrological nonsense." Sigismundo had been pacing. He stopped by the clavicembalo and strummed a few bars by Telemann, thinking, "I wonder if the astrology is still binding on them," he said, "now that we have killed Peppino." "I have studied astrology," Pietro said, "and so have Dr. Orfali and many in our club. There is something in it beyond all the humbug, and we keep hoping we will someday rediscover it. Meanwhile, we have cast many horoscopes to collect data. I assure you, I have never been so astonished as when I cast yours. It is unique." Pietro looked at Sigismundo somberly. "The Rossi read your horoscope the way Peppino made them read it, because he always imposed his will wherever he went. What is significant is that if one believes in such things at all, you will have an extraordinary life. You will travel to many countries and influence millions not yet born. You appear to be virtually invulnerable until your destiny is achieved. It is, Pietro continued, as if no force on earth can stop you. I have seen only 3 horoscopes that compare in any way with yours, and since it is very dangerous to say even as much as I have said already, I am afraid to tell you which 3 men had those particular horoscopes. I will say only that everybody alive has been influenced by them.
Uncle, Sigismundo said, please.
I know it is a burden to be told this, Pietro said. For years I have hidden things from you, so you could have a normal life for a while at least. Even now I dare not tell you all.
Sigismundo played some Vivaldi to calm himself. Can I imagine, he thought, that people might not just say Scarlatti and Vivaldi and Cellini someday, but Jesus and Mohammed and Cellini, or Euclid and Newton and Cellini? How am I to avoid vanity if the stars themselves set such traps for me?
If this is the sign I prayed for, God has a very bizarre sense of humor. But this astrology is all nonsense, he said finally.
Of course, at least it's mostly nonsense. The point is that the Rossi want you alive as their leader, and that is your shield against the hideous games they play. They are trying to bend your mind and your will, but they will not kill your body.
What do I do about that accursed book? Sigismundo asked, finishing off Vivaldi with a bit of his own that seemed to fit. Take it out and burn it myself this time?
Put it in the bottom of your trunk, Uncle Pietro said. Take it to England with you. Read it there, with no fear of inquisitors looking over your shoulder.
Sigismundo stared at his uncle. No, it was not a joke.
You mean it, he said.
Nothing in a book can harm you, Pietro said. Your fear can destroy you utterly if you do not destroy it first. I have read 16 books that claim to be the Key of Solomon.
Sigismundo digested this. And they didn't harm you, he said, drawing the lesson.
There were some real principles of healing in some of them, but they were mostly drivel.
Then why should I waste my time on this book?
To see that what I say is true. If you don't read it, you will always fear it.
Sigismundo thought about that.
Tell me, he asked then, the formula for making the homunculus. He reddened again. You know, mixing manure with your seed.
Uncle Pietro laughed out loud that time.
There, he said, that is why you should read the book and see what nonsense it is.
Frankenstein did not create his creature that way?
No. For reproduction, a woman is absolutely necessary. There is something in the womb, like an egg, the natural philosophers believe, that is just as important as the seed. God would not go to all the trouble of making 2 sexes if only one was needed.
Thank you, Sigismundo said. The church makes so much embarrassment about these matters.
Pietro laughed again.
That formula for a homunculus is in many grimoires, he said. Since the invention of the printing press 300 years ago, it must have been read by thousands, hundreds of thousands. Imagine how many of them stood in their alchemical laboratories, pulling themselves off into manure and waiting for a miracle. Whoever first put that formula into a book had a most heavenly sense of humor, and a very accurate opinion of the intelligence of most students of magic.
Guido Cellini and Sigismundo left Napoli on a coldly sun-bright March day, with the sea calm and the sky hopeful, aboard a 2-rigged sailing ship called the San Francesco. The first few hours, Sigismundo would not leave the deck and go to their cabin. He knew that Greece was in the other direction and Africa too far south to be visible, but still he felt midway between the European present and the almost mythical age of the classics. Scholars forever argued about where Odysseus had sailed or whether Odysseus had ever existed, but Sigismundo could not take such nitpickers seriously at a time like this. He was on the sea Homer had known. Tomorrow they would lay over in Spain, and some scholars claim that Odysseus had met the Cyclops there. It was not a windmill in that case, but a real giant. Even Dr. Vico said so.
Sigismundo started repeating to himself, Polyphloiboithalassus, the loud roaring sea. And by God, Father Ratti was right. It did sound exactly like the noise of the waves against the prow. Polyphloiboithalassus, Sigismundo chanted. Polyphloiboithalassus, the waves answered. He should really be practicing his English, not reviewing his Greek, but this was Homer's sea, damn it, and he was excited by it. He was sailing over 3,000 years of poetry. He wondered if he could think of any words in English that were as purely onomatopoeic as thalassus. He thought of crash, which did sound like something crashing, and wolf, which was the noise of barking. Wolf, wolf. According to Vico, these minor miracles of language prove that our ancestors were poets once. And out of poetry and poetic myth came the laws that shaped a society, which was why one nation could never fully understand another. All peoples are living in different myths. So, standing at the rail and quoting Homer himself, the father of Greek culture, he was literally in transition between Neapolitan mythology and English mythology. Maybe he needed the Greek myth as a bridge from one world to another.
At Sea, March 31st. Dear Uncle Pietro, the philosophers are right. Travel expands the mind. I spent one day in Spain, and already Napoli seems different to me. I wonder what England will do to my mind when we get there next week. As soon as we docked in Malaga 2 days ago, I set off, as you can imagine, to find some students of my own age, since with such a group I could ask anything and everything that curiosity suggested. To make a long story short, I found a group of boys from the local Jesuit college, and to my astonishment they were so bigoted and superstitious that already Napoli seems to me like a place of flaming liberalism. The students are angry at Don Carlos because he has banned bullfighting. However, they are all quite sure that he will be made to see the light and the ban will be lifted because, they say, Spain without the Sunday afternoon bullfight is unthinkable. You know that I am not an experienced traveler. I made a mistake. I told them honestly what I thought of baiting and tormenting an animal for sport. At first they were more amused than shocked, and they set about enlightening me about the virtues of the corrida. I made another mistake. I argued with them. You can guess what happened. I hope that at least my nose will be healed by the time we dock in London City. In any case, there are only a few places that still hurt. The number of beggars I saw astonishes me. I already begin to understand your ideas about free thought and free markets. By comparison with the general condition of Spain, our own Napoli seems rich beyond measure. What I thought was the abyss of abject poverty at home is the norm in Spain. And correspondingly, the Inquisition is stronger and intolerance more entrenched. Just recently, I was told, they tried to burn a Jesuit for a book he had written, and they were very indignant when Don Carlos intervened. He allowed them to burn the book, but not the author. The students say this shows Don Carlos is corrupted by French Bourbon ideas from that side of his family. Students in a Jesuit college, and they not only do not know anything, they do not even suspect anything. If I told them that Pope urinates pure holy water, they would believe it and buy 2 vials. I will have posted this to you when we arrived at London City next week. Your loving nephew, Sigismundo Cellini. 1 week later, that letter was posted to Napoli, and Guido and Sigismundo were sitting in the Turk's Head Tavern on Gerrard Street in London City. Sigismundo had insisted on coming there because Uncle Pietro said it was where the intelligentsia gathered. They had mugs of ale before them. Sigismundo was sipping slowly and cautiously. The drink tasted so foul to him that he was convinced it must be many times more intoxicating than any wine in Italy. The English were all absurdly tall. Maybe that's how they got their empire, Sigismundo thought. Perhaps it comes from looking down when you talk to other races and nations. They were not all blonde, however. It had only seemed that way to his Neapolitan eyes when Papa and he first got off the boat. But they were so light of skin that it almost appeared they were made up to play ghosts in the theater.
The two men at the next table were discussing something called the Stamp Act. Parliament had just passed this act, whatever it was, and both men viewed the event as a kind of criminal lunacy. The taller man, tall even for an Englisher, and red of hair, was particularly vehement about the subject. "The fools will not allow themselves to perceive what they are doing," he said bitterly. "They somehow persuade themselves to forget that the colonists are British too, and can read Coke and Blackstone as well as we can." "It is more asinine than that," his companion, a darker man, said. "I was talking to Burke the other day, and he told me there are more copies of Blackstone in the colonies than there are in all England." "Everybody studies law there," Burke said. "It is their singular passion." "God's hooks. They farm all the bleeding summer and read law all the bleeding winter. The most litigious people on earth." "You were talking to Burke?" the redhead asked. "I was passing the time with him just last night at Dr. Johnson's, and he was addressing the same subject. He came out with one of those marvelous phrases of his, said the colonists were the resultant of the Protestantism of Protestants and dissidents of dissent. God's blood, I could tell Dr. Johnson wished he had said that first." "That is rich," the darker man said. "Too good for a drawing room. I'm quite sure a man like Edmund Burke will find a way to slip it into one of his speeches eventually. If our beloved monarch and his lackeys do not find some excuse to expel him from Parliament," the redhead said dryly. "The Wilkes case is a good precedent, you know. Anybody can be hurled into the outer darkness now, if he becomes too much of a thorn in George's side." "Shite and onions," the other cried. "That is a tender subject with me, sir. Hell and damnation, if the king's coterie can remove Wilkes from Parliament on mere personal spite, we might as well invite the Stuarts back to rule us. The revolution has come to naught." "Christ's nightshirt, you should hear Burke animadvert on the subject." "I can imagine," the redhead said. "Edmund Burke's eloquence is never more sublime than when he is absolutely furious." "Jesus and Mary Christ, sir," the other burst out, "do you know how the bleeding Tories are trying to discredit Burke? They're spreading some cant that he is a Jacobite, by God." "Anything can happen now," the redhead said glumly. "God alone knows what the colonists will do, and Wilkes might return to Parliament to dissolve it, like Cromwell." He drank some more ale and sighed deeply. "Have you heard of Mr. Patrick Henry?" he asked mournfully. "No. Who is he, in the name of God?" "In the colonies, the Virginia House of Burgesses. He almost went over the line in discussing this damned Stamp Act. My American cousin, John Drake, who lives in Philadelphia City, sent me a news story about it. This Mr. Henry, who must be a more enthusiastic demigod than Wilkes himself, actually said, this will loosen your bowels, sir, he actually said, Caesar had his Brutus, Charles the First had his Cromwell, and George the Third..." He paused ominously. "Hellfire and damnation, sir, did he..." He was interrupted, as you might expect, by shouts of treason. He waited until they had died down, and then finished, as demure as a whore at a coronation. "And George the Third should learn from their experience. If this be treason, make the most of it. How does that taste going down your gullet?" "Ora pro nobis," the darker man said. "Lord fuck a duck, I need more ale." Sigismundo could contain himself no longer. He had been listening in fascination, and the mention of the name Drake emboldened him. "Pardon me," he asked excitedly, "but is your name Drake?" Both Englishmen stared at him. "Excuse my son," Guido said hurriedly. "He is sometimes impetuous." "I am Charles Putney Drake," the redhead said simply. "And who, in the name of the Lord Harry, are you two gentlemen?" "I am Guido Cellini, a wine merchant of Napoli," Papa said. "I am Sigismundo, his son, a musician," Sigismundo added quickly. Papa kicked him under the table, but he went on. "Please do not consider me eccentric. It was prophesied once that I would go to Philadelphia City, and at that time I did not even know where that was." Papa kicked him again harder. Sigismundo realized that these men might not understand Abraham's ideas about coincidences, but it seemed too late to stop now. "And there is something stranger. I think perhaps I know another cousin of yours." Charles Putney Drake suddenly looked like a man who had just discovered a turd in the punch bowl. "In Naples? That is, in Napoli?" he asked cautiously. "Yes," Sigismundo said. I have really put my hoof in my mouth, he thought. That would be Cousin Bob, the redhead said. I assume you do not know much about our politics. It is not advantageous to be related to Cousin Bob. In fact, at times it has proved a decided annoyance.
We mean no trouble, Guido said hurriedly. I understand that Robert Francis Drake, Cousin Bob, cannot come back to this country, Sigismundo said. But the coincidence, as if our meeting was predestined.
He felt himself running out of words.
Charles Putney Drake grinned finally. Damn their eyes, he said bluntly. They would accuse me of being a Jacobite even if there were no Cousin Bob. They accuse everybody they don't like of being a Jacobite.
They will accuse me of being a Jacobite next, the darker man said. He held out his hand to Papa.
Sir Edward Babcock, he said, it is a pleasure to meet you, Signor Cellini.
Sigismundo thought he saw a slight exploratory movement of Babcock's fingers. Papa seemed to notice it too, because he stared curiously for a second. Then Babcock extended his hand to Sigismundo. There was no strange movement of the fingers this time. But that means nothing, Sigismundo thought. I'm too young to be a Freemason, so he wouldn't bother testing the grip. Things thawed out considerably, although Papa continued to cast warning glances at Sigismundo, who could not resist questioning the Englishman at length about the political issues they had been discussing. Papa still acts as if he were in Napoli, he thought. John Wilkes, he learned, was a former member of Parliament, now declared an outlaw and living in France. He was a Whig, like Drake and Babcock, but they did not entirely admire him. He was a demagogue, one who appealed chiefly to the mobile party, or mob for short, the propertyless. Nonetheless, Wilkes' removal from Parliament had violated the Bill of Rights, and Babcock and Drake could not tolerate any such experiments upon our liberties, as they said. Sigismundo asked what the Bill of Rights was. It turned out to be a document George III's grandfather, William of Orange, had signed as a condition of Parliament accepting him as their new king when they passed over James II, the Catholic Scotsman whose grandson the Jacobites were still supporting. Sigismundo again felt that the more he learned, the less he understood. If the Jacobites were behind Masonry, these men were on the opposite side, but their ideas sounded very similar to those of Uncle Pietro and his club, and he did think he had seen the grip tested when Babcock shook hands with Papa. From Sigismundo Cellini's Journal. I am starting this journal, and will write a little essay every day, because I wish to retain a record of this strange and wonderful nation. And there are some things I dare not put into a letter to Napoli, even using Uncle Pietro's code. Due to Mr. Drake and Sir Edward Babcock, I have met a most singular Irishman named Edmund Burke, who talks all the time, in classic metaphors, the way the great Shakespeare wrote. I am told this is because he was born in Dublin, where eloquence is studied as passionately as music is in Napoli. Mr. Burke says things like, "Oh, let us not plumb the ultimate metaphysical meaning of property or law. That is the great Serbonian bog where armies whole have sunk." And has a strange Dublin accent called a brogue. Mr. Burke was raised by the Quakers, a most eccentric sect unlike any group I have ever heard of or read about. They might also be called nonviolent Rossi if that were not oxymoronic. They will not take off their hats for the king. They wish to abolish the slave trade. They are peculiar in dozens of ways, and, in fact, they were once persecuted. But in this remarkable nation, all eccentrics become acceptable eventually. In Napoli, a man like Mr. Burke would be leading a secret society. Here he is part of the government itself. He and the other Whigs are forever obstructing the king. They tell him what he may do and what he may not do. Of course, the king does not like this at all, but when the Whigs have enough votes in Parliament, the king himself may not disobey them. This is because of the Bill of Rights they made his grandfather sign. I try to imagine Ferdinand IV being made to sign and obey such a document. It is easier to imagine a cow giving birth to two monkeys and an ostrich. It is easier to imagine Sigismundo Malatesta's naked goddess replacing the Holy Virgin in Notre Dame de Paris. The ale is not so strong as I thought at first. It only tastes strong. Last night I drank 6 full glasses of it at the Turk's Head Tavern and felt only a little bit lightheaded for it. Mr. Drake, who was also there and kindly invited me to his table, drank nearly three times as much and did not seem any the worse, although he did begin speaking loudly and in a silly fashion after a while. He made several remarks about the king's German ancestors that were quite amusing, although very indiscreet, and I doubt that it is biologically possible for such unnatural unions to bear progeny. Then he began discussing local buildings, he's an architect, and ended by proposing a second London fire on the grounds that nothing built in the last century is worthy of being passed on to posterity. He was most droll, especially about Sir Christopher Wren, who he said should have worked for a baker designing wedding cakes, but then he lost his balance and fell out of his chair backward. It made a most terrible crash, but I do not think he was really drunk, because he kept his good humor and spoke most wittily about the mishap, comparing himself to a Mr. Humphrey Dumpty, of whom I have never heard, and imploring all the king's horses and all the king's men to come to his aid. I was too hasty in forming my opinions of the English ale. Last night I drank 20 or more glasses of it with Sir Edward Babcock, whom I met at the Turk's Head. All was going most pleasantly when all of a sudden the tavern began to spin around and around and around like a child's top. I tried to explain that I was not entirely well, but Sir Edward was weeping most piteously about a tombstone in Dublin and the lacerations of Christ, I think, and then he fell out of his chair sideways with a thunderous, awful thump. I don't remember what happened after that. Papa says I must promise not to drink so much ale when I go out alone again, or he will forbid me to go out alone at all, since this city is full of other temptations worse than ale, he says. It seems I was brought home in a wheelbarrow. Papa took me to see a factory today. The owner was a noble lord who had ordered much wine, and Papa asked if we could see the clever machines for which the English are so famous. The factory was outside London City, in a place called Westminster, and at first glance it reminded me of one of the lower bulge in Dante's Inferno. And yet when the machines were shown to me and their workings explained, I understood at once why Uncle Pietro believes that where thought is free, almost anything is possible. Every machine and every part of each machine was the concrete expression of some man's intelligence. It demonstrated that one part of the universe had been understood correctly. This is what natural philosophy can accomplish. The English call it science, and it is awe-inspiring. It is indeed because natural philosophy is hounded by the Inquisition that Napoli is poor, compared to England, and why Spain, where the Inquisition is stronger, is poor still. Every machine is a thought that produces wealth, as Uncle Pietro wished me to understand. And yet, the factory was also depressing. The people who work there are all of them, men, women, and children, almost as famished-looking as our most backward peasants. When I attempted to question one of them, he removed his hat and looked at the floor, just like a peasant. And like a peasant, he answered everything briefly, and I had the impression he was saying what he thought I would want to hear. Of course, all these workers, as they are called, are former peasants. He called me sir at the end of each sentence, just as our servants call me signor. I wonder how many thousands of years of atrocities were required before one part of humanity was trained to look down and say master when they spoke to the other part of humanity. This ex-peasant was named Joyce, and he was Irish. Our host told me later to believe nothing he said because the Irish are all liars, scoundrels, ignorant and superstitious. It sounded just like what everybody in Napoli says about the Sicilians. I keep thinking about that man named Joyce, and I feel there is a specter haunting Europe, but I do not know its name. I suddenly find myself wondering why Sir Edward Babcock has been so kind to me, considering that I'm only a boy. Could he be a sodomite and plotting my seduction? I do not think so. It is probably only that he misses his own son, who is always traveling on the continent, he says. Sir Edward is indeed a most unusual man. When I was enthusing to him about the freedom of his country, where there is no Inquisition, he said ironically, "We have our own tyrants called good taste and common sense. No book yet says all the writer knows and means. The Inquisition is the same, even if it changes its name. The Whigs, I think, are all like that. dreaming of a total liberty that is forever impossible in this fallen world. Yet when I read Mr. Gibbon's Decline and Fall, I could see that Sir Edward was not completely wrong. It is obvious that Mr. Gibbon dares not say what he really means in many passages and can only hint and make inscrutable jokes to force the reader to guess what was omitted because of the restrictions on freedom that exist even here. Will there ever be an age when a writer is free to say all he knows? Another example of how Sir Edward's idealism is entangled with his cynicism. I told him a syllogism I had constructed after seeing the wonderful factory in Westminster, to wit, S. A machine is a concrete thought. M. When our thoughts are perfectly accurate, our machines will be perfectly efficient. P. When our machines are perfect, our wealth will be infinite. Sir Edward replied at once, Yes, but who will own that wealth? The most bold and predatory, I dare say. Papa is taking me tonight to hear a performance by the English Bach. That is, Johann Christian Bach, not his famous brother, Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach, the German Bach. Everybody says the German Bach is the better of the two, but I heard J.C. Bach when he was in Napoli 4 years ago, and I think everybody is wrong as usual. J.C. Bach is as startling and brisk as Scarlatti. There will be three other performers, a man named Leopold Mozart, who is said to be good, and his 14-year-old daughter, Nannerl, who will probably be bearable. Most girls can play competently by that age. And then there is the alleged Wunderkind, Wolfgang Mozart, age 9, who can play anything according to legend. This must be a hoax. No 9-year-old can be worth hearing. J.C. Bach will make the evening memorable, I'm sure. I heard it, but I still don't believe it. The monster is being investigated by the Royal Scientific Society, which was founded by the Jacobites but somehow still survives. I almost wish they will find some evidence that he is a fake. Maybe some adult hides offstage and does the playing for him. This must be the sin of envy. Maybe that is what growing up is, learning that you are capable of every vice you despise. I saw Nannerl Mozart again today. The monster was crowing about his success with the Royal Scientific Society. They have decided he is not a fake. In one test, it seems, they employed Bach, who is as puzzled by the monster as anyone. Bach began a very complex fugue and then stopped suddenly. The monster was asked to proceed. He did so immediately, without missing a beat, and finished it appropriately. I must admit that the monster is likable in certain ways, and that my envy of him is most malign and unfair. But, my God, he does with such ease things I cannot accomplish after years of frantic effort. And he is a foul-mouthed little brat. Swearing, blasphemy, and profane language are as common among the aristocracy here as among the sailors on the San Francisco. I keep expecting inquisitors to leap out from behind a curtain and arrest everybody, and yet I must admit that such earthly language has its own comic poetry to it. As an admirer of the methods of natural philosophy, I decided to keep a record of what I heard in a single evening at the Turk's Head Tavern. My tally sheet shows 137 abuses of the name of God, 231 abuses of Jesus, 333 scatological references to the Virgin Mary, and 358 indelicate references to saints or Old Testament figures. Unfortunately, this record is not complete, since, despite my promise to Papa, I again took a bit more ale than was good for me. Sir Edward Babcock drank much more than I, and again complained bitterly about his son, who is always gadding about the continent and is seldom home. Then he started weeping about tombstones and lacerations again, and the next thing I knew I was being conveyed home in a wheelbarrow again. This is a nation of drunkards. I will learn to be more prudent. I have read most of David Hume's book on the human understanding. I was especially curious because the Dominicans always denounce him as the most dangerous heretic of our age. My head is spinning. Hume has pulled the carpet of certitude from beneath the feet of all previous philosophers and landed us upon our backsides. All that we know, he proves in dozens of ways, are our own impressions. Everything else that we think we know is only deduction and may be extremely probable but never certain. the universe of San Tommaso d'Aquino, with man at the bottom and various hierarchies of angels culminating in the Holy Trinity at the top, is a deduction. So is the universe of the French atheists, with Epicurus's hypothetical atoms floating in this conjectural void. All San Tommaso or Epicurus ever knew were their own sensations. All I know are my sensations. Mr. Hume demonstrates that every philosopher who reasoned from these sensations to some general principle committed an error early on, by which he wishfully confused himself and promoted an inference into a certitude. My head is still whirling. We are all walled cities shouting at each other over the armaments of our preconceptions. Nannerl and the monster and I went to the Royal Zoo today. I must admit it is very difficult to hate him in person. He's so full of fun and jokes, just as his music is. And even his self-importance is comical rather than obnoxious, considering how small he is. When he plays the clavicembalo, his tiny legs stick out straight in front of him, and he looks like some clever toy that a king might own. We heard some of the city peasant children, who are called cockneys, doing a kind of routine that is probably amusing to them only because it offends passing adults. The recital goes like this. "Who shit on the stairs?" one of them asks. "Bert shit," another answers. "Bullshit," Bert objects. "Who shit?" "Frank shit," and so on and on and on until they get bored, which can take quite a long piece of time indeed, or until some passing adult attacks them with a cane and disperses them. The monster thought this was hilarious and kept repeating it endlessly. I was quite mortified that his sister had to hear such language, but Nannerl was not disturbed. She is accustomed to his infatuation with scatology. He seems to be two Shakespeare characters in one, the noble prince and the foul-mouthed clown. It later occurred to me that this crude form of childish humor has the same structure as a fugue. Is that why it amused the monster? That is such a bizarre thought that I reflected further and decided it is also similar to Mr. Hume's analysis of consciousness, which runs around in circles when it tries to find itself. I must think more about that. It is provocative. Harpsichord. That is the one English word I keep forgetting. It is not clavicembalo in this country. It is a harpsichord. 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 The monster tells me he is writing a symphony. Not a symphonia merely, but a full-fledged modern French-style symphony, in four movements, with all the harmonic developments and counterpoint and everything. The worst part is that he can do it. He has already written eight of them, the little monster. I have found out why it is that I virtually never see a beggar in London City. In my ignorance, I had imagined that this was because there were so many jobs in the factories that nobody needed to beg, but that is only part of the story. Begging is a crime here, and anybody caught at it is whipped by the sheriff's men and taken to the highway with a warning that he will be hanged if he returns. Mr. Drake explained this to me, and when I asked him what becomes of these persons, he said that some do eventually find work in factories, some starve, and some become highwaymen or cut purses who live by stealing. There are even gangs, he told me, who are called Mohawks after a tribe of Red Indians. These are ruffians who roam London at night, not merely stealing, but slashing their victims across the faces with knives they carry for that purpose. These Mohawks seem to hate the rich as much as our Rossi do. Every country is different, but injustice and vengeance are the same everywhere. It all happened so fast I didn't even have time to think. I was walking in Grosvenor Park with Nannerl and Wolfie. I can't call him the monster anymore. We were crossing a path, and Wolfie was reciting another piece of scatological lore he had picked up from the Cockneys. Nannerl, as usual, was being aloofly indifferent to his obsession with such language. Suddenly, I heard a great clattering and clashing about, and a woman screaming. I looked back, and there was a runaway carriage. The horses had been frightened by something and were galloping as if the devil himself were at their heels. The coachman was doing everything he could to stop them or at least slow them down, but the animals were mad with fear. My blood went cold when I saw they were headed straight for Wolfie. I threw myself in their path and gave Wolfie a shove that sent him spinning yards out of harm's way. The horses barely missed me by a finger. In fact, I suspect they did not entirely miss me, since my left side is sore. Perhaps I was too excited to feel the pain at the time. I leaped at once to Wolfie to reassure him and calm him. Damn, but he threw his arms around me and started weeping. Well, what did I expect? He's only 9 years old. I found myself holding him, muttering reassurances, as if he were my own son. I felt like an adult for the first time in my life, and for the first time I saw him as a little boy, a boy who happened to have more musical genius than 100 adult performers, but still a child, and at that moment, a terribly frightened child. I was abruptly sickened and ashamed of all my bad feelings toward him. Nanerol was kissing both of us and calling me a hero, and all I could think of was that I had actually hated him just because he had more talent than me. It is easier to see a beetle's hind leg at 20 paces than to see your own vices. The worst part of it is that, shamed as I am, the envy is still there. I keep thinking that when histories of music are written, they will mention the great Wolfgang Amadeo Mozart was once saved from runaway horses by Sigismundo Cellini of Napoli, who wrote a few minor works for harpsichord himself. No, that is not the way of history. They will say he was saved by an unknown Italian merchant or, as some claim, Polish count. Today I finally had an audience with the great J.C. Bach. It was even worse than I expected. I played my latest sonata, and he was most polite about it, but I could tell he was only polite. Somehow I nerved myself to offer a second sonata, terrified that he would make some excuse to get rid of me. He graciously said that he would be happy to hear more of my work. I then played the most complex and experimental sonata I have ever attempted, a piece I am very unsure of, but I was determined to get something out of him besides mere politeness. When I was finished, I hardly dared to look at him. "Amazing," he said, most warmly and sincerely. I turned, and he was studying me with the expression Cristoforo Colombo might have had if he had sailed to the edge of the world and actually fallen off. "What were you trying to do?" he asked simply. I tried to answer, but nobody has ever been able to explain music, not even to another musician. I quoted Telemann on harmony, and then got increasingly obscure and recondite. I might have been a Jesuit explaining transubstantiation, and worrying that I sounded like the most pretentious young ass in Europe. "I thought so," he said mildly. It develops then that he understood me perfectly. Telemann was his godfather and an old friend, but then he asked if I had ever heard anything by his father, Johann Sebastian Bach. I was astonished and felt like an ignoramus. I admitted that I knew only some of his own works and a few by his brother, C.P.E. Bach. "Don't be embarrassed," he said. "Few people outside Saxony ever heard of my father. His work was too special for most audiences. The odd thing is that you sound as if you were trying to imitate him, even though you have never heard any of his works." The upshot of it is that I have a name of a publisher in Saxony for whom I can order some of the works of Johann Sebastian Bach, but meanwhile, that afternoon, J.C. Bach played several of his father's works for me. I was especially thrilled by one called Jesu Joy of Man's Desiring, although a long piece called The Goldberg Variations is closer to what I'm trying to do. Johann Sebastian Bach died in 1750. I am like a man who with great effort and struggle has succeeded in devising a crude printing press 15 years after Gutenberg. Last night I dreamed of the Rossi again. They all had knives to my throat, but they were not threatening me. It was a ritual, part of an initiation. When I woke, I realized that I had been keeping them out of my mind by deliberate effort. It is easy to drench myself in the sights and sounds and exciting people of London City, but back in Napoli and Sicily and God knows how many other parts of Italy, these maniacs wait, confident that when the stars are in the right conjunctions, I will accept my destiny and become their new capo. I decided to invoke the four guardian angels to calm myself and to get back to sleep, but then I started thinking of David Hume again. It was most amazing, but Hume would say the angels were constructs of my mind, just like a French atheist. But Hume would add that the table, the chairs, and the bed were also constructs of my mind, and my mind itself, insofar as I can know it, is a construct trying to construct itself. In a world of mental constructs, the angels are no more arbitrary than any other image the mind projects. Strange that Hume didn't see that implication, or did he? Is he trying to undermine the atheists as well as the theologians and leave us in a vacuum? When I joined Papa for breakfast the next morning, I knew at once that something was wrong. "What is it?" I asked, thinking of a million possible horrors. "Have some tea," Papa said. He has acquired the English notion that this drink is as soothing as an opiate. "It's a letter from Pietro," he told me. "Your Aunt Gina is dead." Then all the details came out in a rush. It was the disease of the heart. She had chest pains, and when the doctor came, it was already too late. The only reason Papa was not weeping outright was because he was surrounded by Englishmen in the dining room. An Italian weeping would just confirm their idea that we are all emotionally unstable. "It was the Rossi," I said finally. "No," Papa said. "The doctor was sure. It was the heart." He didn't understand me, and I was too stricken to explain. The torture of Peppino had not accomplished what she had hoped. It had not ended the grief. To say that her heart was broken is not a metaphor. It goes on and on. Hatred and death, and still more hatred and death. What will this do to poor Tony? Now he has lost both parents in a year. I had a strange experience crossing the English Channel. It was not seasickness. After all, I sailed much further on the trip from Napoli to London City, but something unholy and eerie. Perhaps the death of Aunt Gina was preying on my mind. The waves suddenly looked colder than the Atlantic, and I kept obsessively thinking that I was going to be cast overboard by some freak accident. No matter how I tried to banish it, the image kept coming back to my mind. Cold waves and myself drowning in them. And all the time I was remembering the lines from the Odyssey in Greek about the rage of Poseidon, as if the sea was a living god and wanted to devour me. When I sat in a deck chair and did the relaxing breath, I suddenly remembered my baptism. But that turned into a fantasy too. The priest did not just dab my forehead. He poured on more and more water, more and more like Uncle Pietro that night in the garden. I was very glad to set foot on dry land again. I've been in Paris 1 week and haven't written down a single observation in this journal because I have fallen into sin. Yes, I visited one of the maisons that the nobility patronize. The girl I picked up was from Algiers and was named Fatima. She was most talented, and in the full meaning of the word, formidable. The most remarkable thing about the experience is that it did not feel like sin at all. It was very much like writing a sonata. I know this is more terrible than any of my other heresies, but I could not find anything coarse or animalistic about our play. It seemed not only artistic, but spiritual. I even understood briefly why the ancients allegedly worshipped the generative organs. Is it possible I will end up becoming a pagan like my infamous ancestor, the Prince of Rimini? Anxiety has been gnawing at me ever since that night of pagan sensuality. I don't really trust the church anymore, but the French pox is not one of their myths. People really do contract it in such maisons. The humiliating truth is that I went to Notre Dame yesterday, prayed to the Virgin for protection, and then saw a doctor. He assures me that I don't have it, thank God. He also said, with some asperity, that it should be called the Italian pox, not the French pox. He claims our navigators introduced it to Europe. I didn't argue that, since I don't know the facts. I just thanked him, paid him, and returned to Notre Dame to pray again. I'm still a Catholic when I'm frightened enough. Nobody can understand the state of this nation today. In 100 years, not even the French themselves will believe it. The Inquisition is powerful. This is a Catholic country. Books are burned. Men are placed on trial for heresy. Some are even condemned, just as in Napoli. At the same time, here in Paris, the most radical ideas circulate freely. The aristocracy has decided that it proves their enlightenment to defy the church and encourage heretics of all sorts. Our Rossi would hardly be noticed here, It would almost be quaint.
There is a man named Rousseau who is all the rage. He denies original sin and claims all men are born good.
Obviously, he has never visited Napoli or Sicily.
He is in exile. The Inquisition has that much force, but his ideas are discussed everywhere. If there is no original sin, people say everywhere, then there is no limit to human perfectibility.
I wish I could believe that. It sounds like the kingdom of heaven is at hand.
Then there is a man named Meslier, who is dead and buried, but still raising hell. Like Copernicus, he was sly enough to wait until he was on his deathbed before authorizing publications of his ideas. His book is suppressed, but every dandy and every lady with a salon has read it. It cheerfully urges murdering all the kings in Europe, and then electing a parliament of fathers over 50 years old, on the grounds that such men would have a sense of responsibility.
Another philosopher named Morelli agrees with Rousseau on rejecting original sin, but he also rejects private property. He wants everybody to own everything. This will be accomplished, he says, by taking children from their parents and educating them in state schools, where all tendencies to individuality will be scientifically suppressed. No Leonardos, no Michelangelos, no Scarlattis, no Newtons, just a herd of contented cows. It sets my teeth on edge. As Uncle Pietro says, 100 men can invent paper utopias for every one who can manage a chicken farm successfully.
Morelli is fond of a slogan that I think will have great appeal to all poor people as soon as they learn to read. Chacun selon ses facultés, à chacun selon ses besoins. Roughly, from each according to his abilities, to each according to his needs.
Christ, that is enough verbal gunpowder to blow Europe sky high.
No wonder Mr. Burke regards this country with dread. They are so in love with reason that they have completely lost contact with common sense.
Their music isn't as good as ours either.
Tomorrow we take the coach southward, back toward Napoli. Thank God Papa dislikes these long coach trips as much as I do, so he has booked us onto one that changes horses frequently without overnight stops. We will make good time that way and not be bored stiff with endless bouncing and jouncing around for days and days.
There is one long stop when we get near the border, a little town called Abbeville. I hope it will be peaceful and restful there.